The Off The Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
7:30 Friday morning, give me back that paper, Tommy Rooney. How are you getting on?
Morning, Adrian.
How's the form?
Very well, how are you?
What's going on?
Oh, good. You looking forward to the weekend?
Shehan does two good interviews in a week and then he just decides I'm going to take a day off.
He heads off, yeah.
Really enjoyed his pieces with Andy Lee.
That was great.
Monday.
Well, he did it on Sunday, actually.
Yeah, and then so he should come in more Sundays. And
fresh from the canvas. Well, see, if he comes in on a Sunday, we lose him on a Friday and then you're stuck with me.
Oh, is that what happened? I thought he knocked it out of the ballpark with that, and then he did Kieran Donaghy yesterday, which is a damn fine listen. And
that was great.
He just pat himself on the back so much. Or maybe the producer decided, listen, you did good work this week. Bit of a reward for you.
There's a bit of that. There's a bit of man management involved.
And enjoy your weekend.
Owen's not like yourself. Like, when it comes to you, in terms of producing yourself, I kind of leave you for the week.
Right.
I come to you on a Thursday night.
You do, yeah. Late on a Thursday tomorrow. Night, normally.
Whereas with Owen, there's a bit more man management involved. Different personalities.
Different type of
qualities.
Character. Different type of character, yeah.
Yeah.
Getting themselves set for the weekend. Listen, Tommy, great to have you.
Thanks, Adrian.
What's happening? I've never seen a man with such a pep in his step of a Friday morning.
Why was that?
The good times are back, baby.
Oh, I think they are. Phil Egan wasn't very happy with me in the office this morning because I was excited.
Yeah.
I enjoyed watching a game of football last night for the first time in a long time.
That's fair enough.
Yeah. I have an affliction, you see.
You do.
I'm a Manchester United fan in a lot of ways.
You're the best game of football I've ever seen, I think I heard you say.
That's not what I said. I said it's the best half of football United have played in a long time.
When it comes to misrepresenting stuff, we can go where we like.
They play good football, and it's just that they're going forward. Like they have someone like Bruno Fernandes, who looks like a Manchester United player. The first player they've signed in a long time, who looks like he can add a lot to what's happening out there.
He was the key to all this, is what you're saying.
He just looks a class above, and it's a really simple thing. He's just thinking quicker, and he's playing quicker, and he's trying things. And I know Brian Kerr on Sunday did Sunday's game for Off the Ball. He did United Watford with Stephen Doyle, and I know that he was picking out a lot of the faults when it came to Fernandes trying things a bit too much.
Yes, that's
pushing
right,
it a little bit too much. And he doubled down again during the week on Virgin Media talking about it. But
well, was he saying he wasn't pushing it enough? Was it not? He was saying at times he was too pragmatic, almost
forcing it too much. Forcing it. So like, but United have had so much of sideways football for the last number of years that, you know,
shite football.
Football you'd fall asleep to. You know, there was a rhythm to it, but it was only going one way.
No, listen, it's fair enough. They beat a second string Bruges team who were down to 10 men after about 15 minutes. I think
it was some
save. The good times are back, baby.
It was some save. But look, it's coming from such a low base that what are you supposed to do? Like, what are you supposed to not?
The difficulty now is that you're getting too carried away with it. And
not at all. Are you supposed to not enjoy it?
The Solskjaer trend, every week we come in here, whether we're talking to Gary or Kenny, or this week it's Daniel Harris, like, every week it's like United are here, oh no they're down here, oh they're back up again, no they're shit, oh hang on. Every single week there's this like week on week roller coaster.
And did Liverpool not endure 30 years with that?
Was that, you're up for that, are you?
Are we not watching that with Arsenal now all the time? What I'm saying is that
30
it
years
happens with teams all the time. There's good times and there's
30
bad
years
times.
In the, forget your 40 days and 40 nights, 30 years, well, in the desert.
30 years was a long time, and United's dominance under Alex Ferguson went on for too long as well. I don't think we're going to see either of those trends go on for the same time that they did. There's going to be more ups and downs. That's the way life is, the way sports should be.
And speaking of trends, Odion Ighalo obviously is the greatest thing since sliced bread now.
Nah, he can play with his back to goal. I think we'd enjoy him if he played up front for Ireland. He can do a lot of stuff that the likes of Anthony Martial can't do, and there's a lot of things that Anthony Martial can do that Odion Ighalo can't do.
Exciting times. Look, Tommy.
Would he have missed... Would he have scored that bicycle kick that Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang scored last night? No.
Would he have missed the...
I don't know if he would have missed that. What
Jesus
a miss.
Jesus Christ.
What a miss.
I was watching, I turned on that game.
So you stuck with Arsenal last night?
I fell asleep putting the baby to bed last night. That's what happened to me. And then I woke up at 10 o'clock going, oh Christ, I've missed everything.
Football's over. Listen.
And then flipped on the TV and it was like live. I was like, no, that couldn't be. This must be highlights. And sure enough, we were halfway through the first period of extra time in the Arsenal game. And couldn't believe it. Like... It was a perfect time to tune into the game, as it turns out. But
so when did you tune in? First half, extra time?
Yes, yeah. So
I'd seen a lot of the second half because I kind of tuned out of the United game in the second half.
It was,
it was game over, really. Like I didn't really spend all night.
You tuned out at 90 minutes, whereas I kind of came in.
I just went to bed. I was too tired. Like, but Arsenal were so blunt.
They were.
I wasn't surprised to see them.
After they concede, right, the body language was all wrong, sort of from an Arsenal point of view, which made the opportunity that Aubameyang, but the missed opportunity that Aubameyang got, all the more interesting because you never thought it was going to come. Like, Arteta was on the sideline urging the players, for, come on, we still have a minute and a half. Yeah. Like, let's not hang our heads when the game is done, but come on. Because that's obviously the thing that Arsenal are obviously totally afflicted by, this complex or whatever. Mm. So that made the fact that they got this opportunity that, like, you expected the referee to have blown the whistle before the ball. There was like a half clearance just before that. You're looking at the ref, oh, he's going to blow it. No, he's still going here. The ball comes in. There's a bit of ping, sort of pings around the box a little bit. Falls to Aubameyang. You're nearly looking away with, oh, it's definitely, what? Where's the ball? How did he miss? It was unbelievable. It's the sort of thing that might dog him for a career. Like, but Arsenal fans love him, obviously, and he's...
Was it not prefaced with that bicycle kick, like, minutes before that?
Not minutes, but...
It was close enough. That was 117th minute, and then Olympiacos scored 120.
It felt like a lifetime. It was a brilliant... That
does
goal
it,
was,
skim the post?
Was unreal.
I've only seen the highlights of the miss.
Thing. No, I think it hits the back stanchion.
Okay.
Wow. No, it doesn't hit. It does not skim the post. No, it wasn't even just... He's just... Keeper got a fingertips to it, or it shaved the post. No, it was a proper good miss. Up there with Neto. Did you see Neto?
I saw Neto's miss, I did. We had a bit of a disagreement in the office outside. Yeah. Gary Breen said on commentary that it was a lazy miss, and I agreed with it. I thought it was mentally lazy that he had nicked it by the keeper and he tuned out. He thought he had, you know, he was celebrating before he scored. You don't agree with that?
It's only the terminology, like semantics. He himself puts himself through a goal, slides the ball past the keeper, and you're like, oh, this is great. But he's at full momentum. Hmm. I think there's some. Now, he's a professional footballer, admittedly. But there's some mitigating factor there when you're at full flow and the ball is slightly getting away from you. And also, he's got, which in his mind could be a herd of cattle coming behind him. And I'm sure that whichever player it was that was running after him is probably letting him know that he's there as well. So I'm sure there's a bit of verbals going on. And he just has a bit of a rush of blood. And again, it wasn't close. It was not close. He's missed it by a barn door.
Ultimately, it was only Wolves, and Wolves are true.
And they're like, well true at that stage.
He missed a 14-yard free there. Like, that was very poor.
It was very poor.
It was very, very poor. Yeah. But, like, just speaking of teams who are going to regret last night, I know Arsenal, but Celtic are going to regret that last night.
Yeah.
Celtic are going to, like, Copenhagen knocking them out 3-1, conceded three horrible goals, the last two in particular. Mm. They looked like they clawed their way back into it when Edouard scored that penalty. Took it so well. Chipped it down the middle.
Took it too well, Tommy, in my view. It was a bit too casual. Like, when the ball hits the net, you kind of say, well, look, at whatever, job done. But given what was on the line, which was worse, the Celtic exit or the Arsenal exit?
I think probably the Arsenal exit was worse.
Arsenal exit,
but like, for Celtic themselves, like, they're, what, 12 points clear of Rangers at the minute?
Yeah.
European football means so much to them. You know, I don't know.
Rangers true, obviously.
Rangers true as well.
Right. If you've any thoughts on the Europa League last night, do get them into us over the course of the morning with you between now and 9:30, and plenty to come as well. A bit of a flavour of what's happened overnight. We've just touched on some of that Europa League action. United, Wolves, Rangers all in today's draw for the last 16 of the tournament. Arsenal and Celtic will be licking their wounds having watched on and thinking about what might have been having crashed out last night. We've told you all about that. Matt Doherty, by the way, one of the goal scorers for Wolves last night as they lost 3-2 away to Espanyol, but go through 6-3 over the two legs. Did you see that goal, Tommy?
I did see the Matt Doherty goal.
He's reading business this week in the Irish Times. That's what Tommy Rooney is doing.
I saw Matt Doherty's goal. Yeah, he's at the back post. But, like, is he going to replicate that for Ireland? Like,
what was such a good story that you had to...
I just got distracted by something in the business post. Something to do with coronavirus. Did I see the goal? I did see the goal, yeah. But he's doing that all season. Has he broken into Nathan Murphy's list of the top Irish goal scorers in the league yet? No?
I doubt it.
No, he's only got 4 or 5 goals in the league. But yeah, coming in the back post, he took it well.
Here at home, the two best sides of the country are going to renew acquaintances in the League of Ireland tonight. The champions in Dock make their first trip of the season to Talla to take on last season's Cup winner Shamrock Rovers. And elsewhere tonight, Bowes travelling to Derry City. Leicester City looking for a first Premier League win in more than a month. They're away to the bottom side, Norwich City. Kick off there at 8:00 tonight. Shane Lowry carded 1-under-69 on the opening day of the Honda Classic on the US PGA Tour in Florida. The lead is on 4-under there, so he's 3 shots back. Padraig Harrington finished his opening round on 2-over-par. And in the Pro 14 tonight, Leinster will entertain Glasgow in the RDS. That's a kick-off there of 7:35. That's what's happening in the world of live sport for you. Here's what's coming up between now and 9:30 this morning. We're going to take you through the back pages. Tommy's going to review the business pages for you. Hmm. Just a couple of moments' time, let you know everything that's going on, how the coronavirus has impacted on the markets, I think will be the primary focus in that, Tommy, no doubt. We'll have Daniel Harris talking all things Manchester United following the Europa League last night, and also I'm sure we'll get a few words on Arsenal and a look ahead as well to what are effectively a couple of interesting games in the Premier League too over the weekend. Our top five stories will be coming your way just after 8 o'clock. Tommy Welch is going to join us to preview the weekend's hurling. A big blow for Kilkenny, obviously, during the week with the news that Adrian Mullen is out for the season with that crucial injury. So Tommy's going to give us his thoughts on that. And I don't know if you've seen the Irish dancing clip, but we may well mention that to Tommy at the top of that piece and see what he has to say for himself. The sports news with Tom Malone at about 20 to 9. Alan Quinlan will join us. We'll still a few bits and pieces to talk about in terms of the rugby. Obviously, the fallout from Ireland's cancellation and plenty more as well. But Quinny, for you, just before 9 o'clock, if you have any questions for him, do as well get them into us. We've the Meath footballer Shane McEntee discussing Jarlath Burns' suggestion during the week that inter-county teams should have their training regimes curtailed. So we'll get his thoughts for you just after 9 o'clock. And Phil Egan will round up the show from about 9:15, where we look forward to get his thoughts there on the weekend of Premier League action. But right now, time for the papers. OTB AM. Right, we're going to give you, first of all, a bit of a look at what's happening on offtheball.com this morning. If you want to get yourself across there, Mayo will not receive the remaining $250,000 from the supporters fund. The steering committee there have decided to give that money to some local charities, so it will not be to the benefit of Mayo men's football. And one other interesting piece to mention up on the website there this morning, the top 25 Irish goal scorers in English top flight history is among the best pieces up there. And it's a surprising enough list in some ways, Tommy.
Why is it surprising?
Just with some of the names that are there, I wouldn't have expected. Obviously, we all sort of understood that football began in the 90s, but Nathan Murphy has taken a slightly different look at it. He was the one who instigated all this conversation. Ryan Clark is the author of this piece, top of the list with 136 goals. You've seen the list, obviously.
I'm just looking here now. Frank Stapleton's there, top of the list.
Stapleton. I mean, you won't be surprised that Robbie Keane is there. Niall Quinn. The first surprise is probably John Giles for me.
Why? Why is that a surprise?
Number four. Mainly because I never saw him play and wouldn't have paid a huge amount of attention to what a goal-scoring threat he was. But so 91 goals.
He's the only midfielder in the top five. I think it was also a surprise to John Giles when he was told how many goals he'd scored, because John had a different number in his head and it was more than than a number on the sheet in here. Giles, you wanted to include the cup goals as well. Would you propel him above Shane Long, I think? But
The big surprise is number six as well for me, in that I'd literally never heard this man's name before, Andy McAvoy.
I have to be honest, I haven't heard his name either.
With 84 goals. Anyway, the list goes on.
60s.
And it's well worth going on there to check it out.
Briefly go back to that Mayo story?
Yeah.
Because it broke overnight. Arthur has a piece up on offtheball.com. We've seen a letter that's been leaked from the Mayo supporters, International Supporters Foundation. It's a bit crazy that it's come to this. That the money's now been pulled. That it's been taken from the Mayo senior footballers, that, you know, it was due to go to the academy, and now it's been pushed out to various other charities across Mayo. And also, I think the ladies footballers are also receiving money for gear and for equipment as well. But that's it. The county board seems to have cut ties with O'Leary, and O'Leary, because of the manner in which they have ended dialogue, has pulled the money.
The surprising thing for me is that it's the trustees of the International Sports Fund that have made the decision that the money isn't going there, that it's going elsewhere. Now, there's the handing over the money and there's the spirit of the handing over the money, right? Because I presume by the letter of the law, the handing over the money means that you're effectively putting your trust in the trustees to decide where that money ends up. So you've handed over your 50 quid, or I would imagine in this case,
a lot more.
Vast multiple of that in many cases.
We know the tables in New York cost a lot of money.
Yeah, and that's the binding contract ultimately, that once you we're all going with the idea that this money is going to the Mayo GA men's team, I'm assuming.
Initially, it was
the conversation
it was earmarked
that's
for that
going
initially,
on.
Yeah.
So, and then at some point after that, obviously, they decide that that's not the case. So that's why I say there's the handing over the money and the implicit contract that comes with that, and then also the spirit of the handing over the money. And within that, I do wonder, like, nobody's going to gripe about the fact that this has gone to the Mayo Hospice.
Nobody's
going to gripe about that at all. But it is an interesting dynamic that they have then just decided that this is where that money is going to go, and they've decided the charities, obviously, they've decided that it's going to the women's LGFA team in Mayo as well, which I'm sure is, you know, winding up the men's county board even more.
To an extent, yeah. Well, the money's staying in the county, but again, for the for the Mayo footballers and the Mayo County Board, it's just another circus. Mm. It's just continuing the circus.
I wasn't aware of the Tim O'Leary England.
Well, yeah, I brought that up this morning when we were talking about Edward's penalty last night, the Panenka down the middle, and I mentioned that I'd been watching Perlows yesterday, and you were like, why? Mm. And it's obviously because Tim O'Leary, an English football fan, the same Tim O'Leary, the chairman of the Mayo International Supporters. Well, now we do know this, Adrian, I don't know how to slip by you, that Tim O'Leary at Euro 2012, when England were playing Italy in the quarterfinal, flashed, I think it was Diamante, the last penalty taker. So he's behind the goals, drops his pants.
Gets his mickey out in the middle of it.
You were surprised that he didn't actually turn around and moon him.
I would have thought mooning would have been a far bigger, no comment on the man, but like a far bigger, greater distraction, let's say.
Listen, I'm not sure it worked. I'm not sure that. I think the distance. It was one of those stadiums where there was a bit of a running track around, so maybe it was too much distance.
And his mate was. It was only a still picture, happily, that I saw that had a little. It was blurred out in the appropriate area. But his mate had his hands on his cacks as well. He was either ready to go, had just been in action or was ready to go.
But listen, that penalty shootout, thankfully, Andre Perlos Panenka is the only thing that we remember from that.
Yeah. It's been interesting. I don't know Tim O'Leary from Adam. He was obviously posting on social media fairly busily the other weekend. One of the posts was about him and all his mates who had gone to the Ireland-England game. Mm. All my mates from school, and like they were all Hickeys and O'Briens, whatever it was.
O'Leary's, O'Reilly's.
Yeah, it was with the express intention of saying, look how Irish I am. And here's the man who's like...
But Jerry raised the point during the week. We don't know whether he was wearing an English rugby jersey, and that's... That doesn't matter ultimately, like, because
I'm nearly assuming he was there supporting Ireland, but he's obviously gone on a bit of a journey for himself over the last 8 years.
Yeah, I don't know much about him either. I know we have a profile up on offtheball.com about the whole background of this case and how it came about, and where the money started and where it's now ended up. So that might be it now. Case closed.
Right, we've got to truck through these newspapers. We're going to begin things here with the Irish Independent for you this morning, and it's Hurling's black card won't get Congress green light. Is the thoughts come keys here? Player resistance and public indifference suggest that sanction will suffer insufficient backing. That seems to be the general feeling, all right. Ecstasy and agony for Aubameyang. We've mentioned that unbelievable goal and then the unbelievable miss to go with it shortly after that. And Cullen, not surprisingly, backing skipper Sexton to bounce back from criticism. Writes David Kelly.
Got the Irish Mirror here for you. Igalo sparks big Bruges bash for Ole and Co. Lennon stands by his flops, sadly knocked out, and Gunners dumped at debt. Also down here, Pep's £30 million summer haul. So, seemingly, Man City are chasing Everton defender Mason Holgate. £30 million. Also play as a defensive midfielder and a right-back as well as a centre-back. And Everton are keen to tie him down to a two-year deal. It's hard to know what's ever going to happen with these rumours at this time of the year. Mm.
The Irish Sun for you this morning, Igolo. If Shane was here, he'd be telling you this is a tab in the morning, I think, this morning. Lone Stars tribute to tragic sister as he gets off the mark in United Romp. This was United being a second string 10-man Club Bruges, 5-0 last night. And Igalo's sister passed away unexpectedly last December just, and he paid tribute to her after scoring that goal last night. Another interesting story there from Owen Cowser, by the way, that Kieran Clark is in playoff KO, as it says here, out of Ireland's crunch Euro 2020 playoff in Slovakia next month with an ankle injury, which leaves us down to the bare bones, obviously. And we'll see. Duffy and Egan, obviously, first choice, but we'll see how that pans out.
I've got the Telegraph here for you. Top line, anti-doping chiefs war on marathon. Anti-doping chiefs war on marathon cheats. The Athletics Integrity Unit have adopted a new tactic to crack down on long-distance runners. Again, that Igalo tribute after his goal last night. And at the bottom down here, end of the road. Froome in isolation as coronavirus stops UAE tour. And on the back of the Telegraph, the final whistle column, Simon Briggs. The women's game is crying out for a new dynasty. So obviously Maria Sharapova left this week. And there's a quote that jumps out here. Many feel that today's star worry too much about protecting their image.
Mentioning the Irish Examiner for you this morning. Late blow, it says in the front page here. Oba goes from hero to zero as Gunner shot down at the death. As you can see, Olympiacos celebrating there last night. The big takeaway from Twickenham, right, Sean O'Gara, this team need young blood. And we get into some of those conversations when we've Alan Quinn in the studio a little bit later on. That's the front page of the Irish Examiner sports section for you this morning. Do you want me to run with the Guardian here while you're...
I've got through the business section of the Irish Times and I'm into Sports Friday. Fernandez shines as United look like real contenders. contenders for Europa League now. We're not saying contenders for the Premier League yet, so don't be getting too excited. And there's more pieces there on the Europa League. And also, Liverpool make pre-tax profit of 48.9 million euro after their 260 million euro spend. And there's also a piece here on Jack Byrne, maybe the key to Rovers passing the test against Dundalk tonight, a top of the table clash in the League of Ireland.
This is a headline you're going to see a lot more of, I would think, over the coming weeks at least. Anyway, coronavirus threat to sport. Italy can still host the Euros as Froome faces test in UAE. These are just reflections from Paul McInnes of the latest developments in relation to the spread of coronavirus and the impact that it's absolutely going to continue to have in the world of sport, as we've seen here as well, even over the last few days. And then Red Juggernaut over on the right-hand side is that photograph of Scott McTominay. United cruise through to the last 16. Fred and McTominay there, and new boy Fernandez run riot against 10-man Bruges.
There's just one other little story here in the Irish Times. Wilder offered payoff to pave way for Fury Joshua. Tyson Fury's promoter Frank Warren is hoping that Deontay Wilder will accept a payoff to waive his right to a rematch. So that's going to roll on. And I've also got the star as well. Iggy Top, Igalo's goal last night.
Having that.
Pep looking at Holgate, as we mentioned a little earlier. And Leo prays for Sexton. Leo Cullen has backed Johnny Sexton's Ireland captaincy. And his adamant the out half will prove his doubters wrong.
Shock horror, Tommy, is what you're saying. The Times of London as well, on the front page of this. Top sports events under threat from coronavirus. Doubts over mass gatherings. Illness could spread for months. And the army in the UK preparing for emergency action. So that's where we're at with that grim stuff. Then the back pages, it's Twickenham 8 p.m. kickoff. Not really of great interest to us. Ireland, England going to play Argentina later on the year. Emerick Laporte may be out for a long time. Paul Hurst here saying that he's going to undergo a scan at the club's training ground a bit later on today to see exactly the extent of that hamstring injury. And virus ends Froome race, as we told you there a little bit earlier. Sinead. That's it. You're going to be back to us a little bit later on. Tommy, we've top five stories to get through a little bit later in the day, but it's 7:52 on this Friday morning. Really delighted to have you along with us on OTB AM this morning, the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. Do get your comments coming into us over the course of the morning and we will endeavour to bring those to air. But we're going to talk a little bit of football in just a few moments' time. The football writer Daniel Harris will be on the line, but last night, as he is every Thursday night, John Giles joined Nathan. A crossover of Roy Keane and Kevin De Bruyne. John, considering what a different attitude might do for the Belgian on the show last night.
Did his stuff last night, Nathan, and that's what you want to be doing. All right, Christopher, he doesn't do that every week. Yeah. Why don't you do it every week, you know? And I think what's happened to him last night as well, playing in the position he was playing in, people were getting the ball to him. Now, I don't agree with that generally with De Bruyne. I think he's got the talent to stay in the middle of the field and dictate everything. I think he's got the talent to do that. I don't know if he has the mind to do that. But again, if the team is defending like they're defending, right, and as a group, he wouldn't be exposed in any way. You know what I mean? So when the ball, most of the time, see, a lot of times they didn't have the ball, but when they did have it, then he was in a good position to receive it. And then he could do the damage from there. So maybe, like, if you wanted to get the best out of De Bruyne, maybe you should play that way every week. But you're not going to. I think if he's really doing this stuff, he would be in the middle of the field dictating. I think he's got the ability to it. There's no doubt about it. Has he got the temperament to it? I haven't seen it. He can be brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. He's a very, very gifted player. Very gifted player. But I'd just like to see him with the Roy Keane attitude, for example. I mean, anytime I talk about attitude, we go to Roy Keane because the attitude was 80-90% of Roy Keane's game. You know what I mean? Roy Keane wasn't as gifted as a player as De Bruyne is. Now, I'm going to run right because he's great at what he did, but the attitude that he have, if you put that attitude into De Bruyne, he would be the best player in the world.
John Giles on with Nathan last night. You can check out the full piece as always up and off the ball.com. Daniel Harris, good morning to you.
Hello.
We could all do with a bit more Roy Keane in us, I suspect.
Absolutely, yeah. We could all do with knowing Roy Keane, being Roy Keane, all of those things.
Yeah, certain aspects of Roy Keane, I think it might be fair enough to say. But not an unreasonable point that, like, De Bruyne at his best, obviously, we've seen can be and is one of the finest footballers on the planet, but just missing a bit of that, I suppose, aggression is probably the short word for it.
I'm not sure about that. I think there are different kinds of aggression. And Roy Keane had the kind of the traditional proper football man aggression. But the way that De Bruyne plays football is also with aggression. And I think in the end, he's just a different kind of personality to Roy Keane. And you see the way, different personality in the way that he plays. He's more of an artist than Roy Keane. And I don't know if if you gave Kevin De Bruyne Roy Keane's personality, whether you necessarily see the same player or the Kevin De Bruyne that we see with Roy Keane's aggression, you might just see a whole different thing. You might lose some of the artistry, I don't know.
Yeah, it's also like, for De Bruyne's point of view, like he's 29 a bit later in the year, like this is not a player that is necessarily going to transform his personality at this stage of his career.
No, I'd say that seems unlikely, and he is already, and has been for years. I mean, I know people like to say that it was Eden Hazard till he moved to Madrid, but as far as I'm concerned, De Bruyne's been the best player in the Premier League for quite a few years now. And definitely, if I was allowed to sign one player, it would be him.
Yeah. Right, the Manchester United with the Europa League last night, Daniel, the Solskjaer revolution gaining momentum was one newspaper headline I saw this morning, so you probably know where I'm going with this, but 10-man... Club Bruges side last night, who in itself, they were down to probably not quite a second string, but certainly headed in that direction. Is Revolution a bit too strong this morning?
I'd say Revolution's not just that it's too strong, it's probably the wrong word, in that what we're seeing has been evolution, not revolution, because it's been quite gradual. He took over, and since he took over, he's got rid of players that he didn't want and got some players that he did want. And slowly we're seeing some improvements. And I think I've been on here more or less since the beginning, and even since before he was fired, since before Mourinho was fired, saying that if you gave this United team a decent midfield, then you'd see a much better team. And that's what's happened, because he's obviously signed Bruno Fernandes. And it's quite terrifying to think that had McTominay and Rashford not got injured when they did, United probably wouldn't have signed him, when he's clearly a player that they should have signed in the summer, or at least at the beginning of January, never mind panic bought towards the end of the window.
Yeah.
But you're seeing Fernandes, and now they've got McTominay back, and they've also got Fred in the team, and those three, they're not the greatest midfield that United have ever had, but they are, you can call them a midfield without feeling embarrassed at what you're saying. And that's making an enormous difference. And Fernandes just looks a lot like the right player at the right time. And he's doing what Pogba was meant to do, in that he's not only playing well himself, but he's elevating the standards of the players around him.
Yeah, like you're saying, the fact is that they've bumbled their way to a degree into this. Strategy seems like it might be a stretch, but in terms of the reasons that they're here, it wasn't quite by design other than desperation to some degree.
I'm not sure that Solskjaer has bumbled his way to this point, in that I'm pretty sure he wanted more players than he was given in the summer. And a guy who played in front of Beckham, Scholes, Giggs and Keane, the greatest midfield that English football has ever seen, I don't think that he previously thought the midfield that he had was adequate. I just think that he was given limited funds and spent them in other areas. Mm. The board, on the other hand, have absolutely bumbled their way to this point. But we got there in the end. And what United need to do now is, rather than sit there looking in the mirror, admiring the work that they've done, which Ed Woodward strikes as all as the person who will do that, they need more players of Fernandez's quality, not just to sit there being pleased that they've got him. Because ultimately, and you saw this with Pogba too, if you're a team playing United, you will be thinking, if we stop Bruno Fernandes, then more or less we stop United. And that's not entirely true, but it's also not far from the truth. And what United need to do now is, in the summer, sign another attacking midfield player to play with Fernandes, and then you'll start to see a proper team developing.
Yeah, you say there, we got there in the end. Like, it does strike me that it's continually, obviously, a work in progress from a Manchester United point of view. There might be a temptation over the coming weeks, if we see much more of this revolution, as it's termed, or domination at least, anyway, that Manchester United, the powers that be, feel perfectly happy that actually if the season was to begin tomorrow, we're in pretty good shape to contend for the title. Still not the case, though, yet, Daniel, I suspect.
No, I don't think they would be thinking that at this point. I think that they might, if United managed to finish fourth this season, or then there's a fair chance the board might think, well, there's no need to get too excited in the transfer market, because finishing fourth with this injury list would be quite good. So you would expect to have better luck with injuries next season and not finish fourth. But if Paul Pogba goes, then United will have a decent wedge to spend without actually investing any money. So, and it's quite easy now to see the team developing and to see what they need to do to strengthen. And I would say that if United are able to find the money in the summer for a right winger, another attacking midfield player and a striker, then you're starting to talk about a proper team that is able to give anyone aggravation on a good day, and also will have a little bit of strength in depth given what they've already got and what they've got coming through. So it's not impossible to conceive of United being good next season, but with owners like United have, you're never sure what's going to be.
Yeah, and the reality is that they could go and have done, could buy all of those players you've just mentioned. They may not be the right players, of course, is the thing. One of them who looks like he might, and you've mentioned him already there, Bruno Fernandes. How excited should United fans be about this guy?
It's only been, what, 4 games? So there have been players who've done well after 4 games before. The one that particularly springs to mind is Angel Di Maria. But then he's frequently the person who is chastised for the fact that he was a signing that completely failed. But the reality is that Louis van Gaal lost his balls and decided not that he couldn't risk playing Angel Di Maria in midfield, so started trying to play him up front and on the wing in order to hide him. And the main reason why the signing of Di Maria didn't work wasn't Di Maria himself, but it was actually van Gaal. So I wouldn't say that that is a good comparison. But what we also see with Fernandes is not just the ability, and he has a lot of ability. Aside from the fact that he's got a great eye for a pass, he can execute a pass, he's got a great engine, he's quick, and he's got an attitude where he won't take nonsense off his teammates and he won't take nonsense off himself. And all those attributes make him a really good player. So at the moment, it's kind of hard to see what his weaknesses are. He will have them. And he happens to be in great form. There will be times, presumably, when he's not in great form either. And the thing that differentiates the really high-level players from the good players is how high their bottom level is. And to go back to Roy Keane, that was why Roy Keane was so good, was that even on a bad day, he still gave you a 7 out of 10. Mm. And United don't have a lot of players like that at the moment. And if Bruno Fernandes can become one of those players, then you're talking about one of the best players around. And that is really what United need him to be.
Yeah, Odion Ighalo shows signs as well, and very early days really for him, but showing signs of that. Obviously got his first goal last night. Don't know how he trended, Daniel, last night, if he was top of the trends on the back of that or not, but time will tell on that one. How good can he be, and when Martial is back, where does all that jigsaw fit together?
Well, I think he's just another option. When Martial's back and Martial's not being rested, he doesn't play. But what you saw from Ighalo last night was that he's a centre-forward and Martial's not really a centre-forward. He's more of a centre-forward than he was in August. And after the other game, I think Solskjaer said that they've been trying to train him to make centre-forwards runs and they've been telling him over and over again what a centre-forward has to do. And you don't have to tell Ighalo that because he knows. He's just not that good a player. So he comes and shows for the ball at the right time. So he's an option for United to play into. And when the ball's going across the face of the goal, like it did last night, you know that he will be there to see if there's a tap-in. And Martial isn't that player yet. He's just a much, much more talented player than Ighalo. So I think that Ighalo was actually, in some ways, I mean, people took the piss out of United for signing Ighalo because it was a panic buy. And you would always take the piss out of that kind of thing when it's like, how on earth has this bloke just turned up at United? But in some ways, the signing made sense because they needed a striker. And they needed to not spend a lot of money on a striker who wasn't going to be that useful to them after the summer. So they found someone who knows how to play the position, who's played in the Premier League before, who they only have to have until the summer and doesn't cost them a load of money that then they're not able to spend on the player that they actually want. So although it's a bit shady that he is represented by the same bloke as Solskjaer and he, at the end of it, is performing a function in the squad that wasn't performed before him. The one thing I'd say about Ighalo is perhaps you wouldn't necessarily want him getting minutes that should go to Mason Greenwood. But Greenwood should be getting enough minutes anyway so that that isn't too much of a problem. And on the strength of things, what we've seen so far, he actually looks like he was a smart acquisition.
Yeah, and if he continues to score goals, I suspect that United fans want to see Mason Greenwood in there, obviously dissipate slightly as well. Maybe a bit of a luxury, obviously, the Europa League, and feel free to shoot this down, Daniel, as I'm sure you will. The Europa League is, the pressure cooker is slightly less for them. It's almost a shot to nothing in some degree, whereas obviously with the Premier League and it's Goodison Park on Sunday, they're still trying to hang on to Chelsea's coattails there. The pressure is obviously one factor that gets dialed up significantly on Sunday, which may have an impact on this evolution.
Maybe. I mean, to start with the Europa League, I would much rather win the Europa League than come fourth because it's a trophy. It goes on the list of trophies that you've won. It's a European trophy. And the more European trophies you win, the better. And just speaking as a supporter, I want to go to Gdansk. I want a trip to Gdansk in May to watch United pick up a pot. And that the things that you remember are not remember that season we came fourth. It's remember that season we won that. And those memories are a lot of what football's about. I remember going to Vigo and to Stockholm when United won it last season, and no one who was in those places was complaining that United didn't come fourth. They were just great days and great times going to a foreign country to watch United with your mates. And that is what's going on here. And that's what I want again this season. And also, winning the Europa League the last time United won it in 2016 was almost, that was set up for Mourinho because the standard of the team was miserable. Yeah. And if Jose Mourinho can do one thing, it's pick up a trophy when the standard is miserable. Whereas this season, the standard's actually quite high. And if United are able to win a trophy against teams like Inter, like Getafe, like Leverkusen, that would actually be a pretty decent achievement. It's true that, like you say, there is less on the Europa League now because United are actually in with a pretty good chance of finishing in the top four. And you're also right that the pressure is on Everton this week, because what United have got now is they've got three difficult games. They've got Everton, they've got City, and they've got Spurs. And then after that, they've actually got a pretty straightforward run in. Yeah. But they could easily lose three of those games, two of those games. And then in the run in, they're coming from behind and you're asking them to go on a ridiculous winning run. Like it might require something even close to championship form to get fourth from there if they could now go and fall 9 points behind. But if they can get a decent return from those next three games, then they'd be strong favourites, as far as I see it, to finish in the top four, because they have by far the easiest run-in of all those teams. But they do need to start producing back-to-back quality performances. And we started to see signs of that, and they've got available the players that will hopefully enable them to do it.
Yeah, it's like that race for fourth is probably the most interesting thing that's happening in the Premier League at the minute. Arsenal, obviously one of those teams that mid-table, but really in with a strong shake of it. Everything you sort of perceive to know about Arteta's job at Arsenal at the minute is in relation almost to the mindset, right? Like changing that sort of losing or fragile culture, at least. You look at last night's game, and I don't know how much of it you saw, but in extra time, Aubameyang does what he does, and you think, This actually could really turn here. I'm talking about the goal that he actually scored. And then obviously things slip away from them. There's the manner of Aubameyang's miss at the end. Like, it's on small things like that changing that culture and that mindset, that, like, if those things had gone Arsenal's way last night, it's very easy for Arteta to go back into that dressing room last night and to go back into training this week and sort of hammer home the fact that we're now becoming like that granite rock. We are becoming this force. We're changing our culture, changing our mindset. It becomes challenging, almost more challenging after last night.
I think all of that takes time. And if you look at, instead of looking at Arsenal last night, I'd look at them over the whole period under Arteta, and they've been better. And they really just needed to get rid of Unai Emery. And getting rid of Unai Emery, just that, he was such an innovating presence, has made a big difference. But I think the thing with Arsenal is it's a huge job. Even if they had a load of money, which they don't, it's a huge job, because ultimately there's a lot of, the players aren't good enough at Arsenal. And I feel very differently about the Arsenal squad to how I felt about the United squad. I look at the United squad and I see quite a few really good players who just need a run of games and they need better players around them. Whereas if you offered me the run of the Arsenal squad and said, you can sign any of these players for the team that you support, the only players I'd really want are under 20. And they are not going to be able to define a team for you at this point, how brilliant though they are. Bukayo Saka is a brilliant talent. He's a superstar. But ultimately, he's 18 years old. I really like the look of Martinelli. I really like Joe Willock. But aside from that, there's not a lot of quality in that team. Mm. And the fullbacks are okay, but they haven't got any good centre-backs. Granit Xhaka's not good enough. Mesut Ozil is on the way down, not good enough. Alexandre Lacazette, not good enough. Nicolas Pepe, because he's new to the league, you'd give him another season, but not good enough. Him and Lacazette both scored fewer goals this season than Scott McTominay. I mean, they should be embarrassed that be the case. Scott McTominay's missed 2 months with injury. These guys are there to score goals. Aubameyang is a class act, but might leave, and also is not the future. So you look around that squad and you think, Guendouzi, another one. Some talent, but very high in my list of players who are nowhere near as good as they think they are.
Yeah.
These players are not going to take Arsenal to where they want to be. And Arteta somehow needs to spend the next couple of months working out who he wants to stay, who he wants to keep, who's going to be his first 11 for next season. And then He needs to be somehow finding value to use whatever limited money he's going to be given by Stan Kroenke, who likes taking money out much more than he likes putting money in, and work out the players that will elevate his team, because that is what he needs. Arsenal is a mammoth job, and they might be, they'll be better next season because Arteta seems to have some idea of what he's doing. But if I was an Arsenal fan, I would have been slightly concerned by what was said after the Everton game, when, first of all, Leno said he was at fault for a goal that Richarlison scored. And he says that in the end, that he was unlucky, Richarlison was lucky, and it didn't matter because Arsenal won anyway. Now, that is not the mentality of a winner. A winner says, yes, it was my fault, and is obsessively thinking about what he could have done to make that better. Because ultimately, it was his fault. It wasn't unlucky. Richarlison wasn't lucky. It was a balls up, mm-hmm. and it was his fault. And also, the proper winners aren't thinking about, well, we won anyway. They're thinking we might not have won. And the pride in personal performance is such that they're obsessed about not making that mistake again. And the other thing that would concern me was Arteta said for the first 65 minutes, it was exactly the kind of performance he wants to see. And watching the game, I did not see that. So Arsenal were good for about 20 minutes, but that is it. And it was not a great performance. And on the balance of good chances, they could have lost. Then they had a good second half and Everton's finishing was poor, so they didn't lose. But there needed to be an acknowledgement that it was a long way from a good performance, from what a good side would consider to be a good performance. And I was surprised that he was getting so rhapsodic about it. So the other thing with Arteta is that he knows what pretty football is, but does he know what a good defence is? And does he know how to coach a good defence? Does he know how to drill a good defence? Does he know how to buy good defenders? Because Pep Guardiola doesn't know that. Pep Guardiola doesn't know what a good defender is. He knows what a footballing defender is, yeah. and he knows how to drill a side's press brilliantly, and he knows how to pick the best, and he knows how to have a midfield that can keep the ball away from his defence, but he doesn't know bugger all about good defending. And that's not to criticise Pep Guardiola, who's obviously some kind of footballing savant, but he's never had a team that is good at the back. Never. He's had a team with one or two good defenders, with loads of great footballing defenders, and he's had teams that don't concede a lot of goals because he can't get the ball off them because they're brilliant, but he does not know what a good defence is. And yeah. there's no evidence that Arteta knows that either. And what he should be doing is finding someone who does know. And as it happens, I feel the same about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Does Kieran McKenna know what a good defender is, how to coach defending? I don't know. Like, if I was these people, I'd be thinking, like, if I was Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I'd be thinking, I need to get Rio Ferdinand in to do some sessions with Eric Bailly. Yeah. If I was Mikel Arteta, I'd be thinking, who can I get in to coach my defenders to at least defend as a coherent unit? Because they do not defend like that. They didn't defend like that against Everton. They didn't defend like that last night either, because he doesn't have defenders that do that. And David Luiz is capable because he did it under Antonio Conte, who does know how to coach defenders, but he did it in a back three and Arteta's trying to play him in a back four. So he needs... Defending is about cohesion and understanding. It's not about individuals. Yeah. And Arteta needs to find a way of imposing that. And if he is not the answer to imposing that, he needs to find the person that is.
If only they had a long list of former club legends who knew a thing or two about defending. We'll see how it all pans out. Daniel, thanks, William, for taking the call this morning.
No, I'll see you again.
Daniel Harris on all the days. Football overnight, obviously, and look ahead to the weekend as well. We'll have plenty more to come. Phil Egan's going to join us to look ahead to the weekend of Premier League 2 a little bit later in the show. We've plenty more besides as well. Alan Quinlan's going to join us in studio to talk rugby. Tommy Welch will be on the line to look ahead to the weekend's National Hurling League. And Shane McEntee on the suggestion by Jarlick Burns that intercounty teams should have their training regimes curtailed. All that to come. OTB AM. All right, 8:15 on this Friday morning. You're watching OTB AM, the sports breakfast show from Off the Ball. We've picked out five stories that we think might be of interest for you this morning, and they include Ronan O'Gara's calls in the Irish Examiner this morning for new blood. The Europa misses last night. I don't know how much of that you were watching last night, but a couple of big ones from Aubameyang and from Neto as well. The fallout from the GA, the Mayo GA situation in relation to the international fundraiser, that money is now going elsewhere. Coronavirus and the impact that that is having on the world sport at the minute, and which should continue to have, you would think, by the looks of things for the next while. And the GA presidency up for grabs as well at Congress tonight. So that's the top five stories for you this morning. We might start with that last one, actually, Tommy, because it's, am I overstating it? Say it's interesting stuff over at Croke Park tonight when Congress convenes for a couple of days, beginning with the election of the new president, one of whom we had obviously in studio during the week, who had some interesting stuff to say about the how you would curtail, I suppose, the current trend for inter-county teams to train the arses off themselves, essentially. Jarlett Burns was in studio talking about that. So the runners and riders are Jarlett Burns, who seems to be something of a favourite for this. Larry McCarthy also is in the mixer for it. He's New York-based. He's a GA trustee and was on the management committee as well, as so many of these candidates have been. He's originally from Cork. He's a lecturer in New York and is saying that he's, if push comes to shove, and he does actually end up winning this thing this evening, that he's prepared to wing his way back to Ireland and set up base here and pack everything in from New York. So he's one of the contenders for it. Jim Bulger as well, not that one, another one. He's from Carlow, outgoing Leinster chairman, GA Management Committee as well. Gerry O'Sullivan from Cork, GA Management Committee there. Mick Rock from Roscommon, who's been chair of the National Club Committee and previously on Central Council. So they're the runners and riders. Jarlett Burns, possibly going to get it done. We'll see how all that goes.
You're a star there. You're a star, no?
The Irish star.
Kieran Cunningham had a couple of quotes this morning. I have it here. Sorry, Kieran Cunningham had a couple of quotes this morning from Peter Quinn, the former GA president. And, like, that's the thing about this. Like, it's... To me, on paper, Jarlett Burns seems like the right type of person to put in because he's been working towards this for a long time. He's a high profile in the game. He's got strong connections in the game. He's got nephews on the Armagh panel. He's got a son who's starring for Armagh now. And he's obviously done it all the whole way through.
Yeah.
You'd imagine that he has the perspective of a former player, of a manager, and of somebody who's been involved in administration as well. And we've obviously heard from him on the show before. And he said some things that I really agree with. He said some things that... would worry some players as well. I know that we're going to be speaking to Shane McEntee a little later on. When Jarlett Burns made the proposal this week and he said it to Joe on Wednesday night that he wants to reduce training, inter-county training, a lot of inter-county players don't agree with that.
Mm.
And I don't think that's a major surprise. But something has to be done in terms of like managing the calendar, in terms of fixing the problems that are in the game. I don't know whether that's the issue or not, or whether that's the answer. I also don't know whether GA president actually has the remit to do this. Can they actually force change? And that's why I'm going back to this piece of Kieran Cunningham. He quotes Peter Quinn 13 years ago, one of the most praised of all GA presidents. He gave an interview where he didn't pull any punches. He spoke of a civil service mentality in Croke Park after there was an explosion in staff numbers that was both unnecessary and unexplained. But at that time, he asked, was there a need for a president who was amateur when they've got the likes of the Director General, Tom Ryan, running the show inside? Somebody who just breathes in for a couple of years, like John Horan has done, and is there for press events, is you know, doing his whatever he has to do, going around the country canvassing, signing off on things. But ultimately, that person breathes in. They're not there in a full-time contract. They're not there on a long-term basis. They're in for a couple of years. They have a term. Is there a need for it in the GA anymore? Mm. I don't know.
It's a ceremonial sort of a position almost, isn't it, to a degree? That's part of the function of it. They're a bit... they can be a bit of a eunuch about them, like they're not all that there to be necessarily that effective. But my overriding thought on that would be that, you know, like obviously we had a very similar position in a higher profile office in this country for a lot of years, where we had somebody in the shape of Paddy Hillary who was in Ars Neutron and wouldn't be seen from one end of the year to the next. And it was very much a ceremonial thing. And then we'd Mary Robinson come in and totally revolutionise the role. Like, you can accept that that's the way things have been. And there are obviously parameters within which the president is going to have to work, which is what Mary Robinson did, but also was a voice for so many worthy causes, I suppose.
Personally, that's why I'd like to see Jarlett Burns in. I believe that he'll attempt to influence the game in a positive way. Whether or not his ideas on training or his perhaps maybe highfalutin ideas of regulating the training and improving leadership in the GA is attainable.
You think those proposals are bullshit, do you?
I don't know if I think they're bullshit. I wouldn't shoot them down that quickly. I know there'll be strong opposition from inter-county teams, but there has to be some way of curtailing the 14-month calendar that we have, or the fact that someone in, say, Wicklow or Leitrim, they have a new manager coming in every couple of years. They're essentially going on trial every November with a new manager. There's no, like the manner in which it is in say, Mayo or Tipperary this year. Aidan O'Shea, you don't need to come back until February. Or the Dublin lads, they go off on holidays after winning All-Ireland. They don't need to come back. They've got lads coming in to do the O'Byrne Cup and played at pre-season competitions, and their seasons aren't as long as the likes of, you know, Leitrim or Wicklow, as I said.
Absolutely.
Already. Do you know, and travel commitments and all these things. Like, there has to be a way of dealing with it. Perhaps Burns' proposal is a bit OTT. I don't know whether you're going to actually just stop teams training twice a week.
I think it's nearly impossible. Do you think that current players, I'm probably asking this question knowing the answer, but that they've too much sway and too much say? I'm not saying that they shouldn't have any, but too much say when it comes to deciding what's right for the intercounty game? Because my view on it, sorry, would be that they are obviously a heavily vested, have a very heavily vested personal interest in what they're doing at the minute, which might not be the right thing for the game going forward.
I have to say I disagree with you on the basis that I actually don't think they have that much of a say. I feel like they've become more vocal in recent years. But how much difference do they actually make? The people with a say are the people who are going to be voting in Congress. And there's a lot of issues with democracy in the GAA and with just transparency of voting and the manner in which it's conducted and how you need to get a certain amount of votes and how those votes are canvassed for and how they come about. There are a lot of issues, red tape involved. Yeah. I don't think the players actually have that much of a say. I think that's overstated, how much of a say they have. Like, perhaps with the black card in hurling, the GPA conducted a survey during the week and Arthur brought to my attention yesterday that they actually got about 97% of hurlers in the country to vote. There was such a huge return rate. Like, the players need to have a say. They want to have a say. I'm not saying they should have 100% canvass of a vote, but it should be a strong...
It was an overall survey with a question on it about the black card
yes
hurling.
Or no. And 11%
Footballers get canvassed for that?
I'm sure they do, 100%.
Footballers have an input as to whether the black card and hurling should...
No, the hurling, no, I don't think so. I think that was just canvassing the hurling squads. That was canvassing all the intercounty hurling squads. So whether it's Leitrim competing in the Laurie Maher Cup or it's Tipperary competing for the Liam McCarthy. I don't think they have that much of a say. I think they should have a say, but not as much as... are you worried they have too much?
I would. It's more a concern that, like, what's right for them now, what's right for you now, if you get the call up, what's right for you now to be playing football for me will be a very selfish view. That might not be the right thing for the game.
Yeah.
5 years' time or in 7 years' time.
Sure. No, and a lot of players would probably, they wouldn't care about what
happens. No, they don't care. That's my point. They don't care. They want to know what's the best facilities I can get, the best. Etc. etc. etc.
But I'm not sure they have that much of an influence, anyways. I honestly don't.
Focused Horan endorses Mayo Board's stance against O'Leary. This is a story that we touched on a bit earlier on, but it's a reaction from James Horan, which was interesting to see. This is in the Irish Examiner with John Fogarty this morning. Obviously, in light of Tim O'Leary's tweets last weekend, he's deleted his account since. Horan out, obviously, was the.
It's gone off. Things. Hashtag Horan out. And then he doubled down a little later on. I know the tweets were deleted, but myself and Owen managed to find them.
It's a bit of screen grabbing.
A bit of screen grabbing, yeah. But you've got to be quick with the screen grabbing.
James Horan was on the My Own News podcast, which you can check out at their website. But quotes from it in the Irish Examiner this morning, where it's put to James Horan, obviously, about all this stuff. And he, as you would expect, walks that sort of high wire of not wanting to fire in another grenade about all of this and sort of says, listen, it's not that big of a deal. And that there's a lot of work going on in Mayo anyway, because obviously one of the impacts of the withdrawal of funding from the money that was raised was that some of it was to go obviously to the Mayo Academy. But he says there's lots of work going on there with the chairman, and they'll still be on track for having some sort of facilities in place. But when it came to the hashtag Horan out, he was asked obviously if this sort of stuff would affect him. Not anymore. Maybe it did in the past. And look, everyone reacts differently. I'm so busy. We've 40 guys in here and a support team, and everyone is trying their utmost to develop and grow.
Mm.
So what James Horan has done there is given an interview with the express intention of not saying something that's going to create a massive headline out of it. I'm sure, quietly, there was a... I'm sure that his reaction to that hashtag Horan out at the weekend, quietly...
I can only imagine what his reaction was, but like... As we've said, this is a circus that's been ongoing for a long time.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's good that it's come to a head in February and that something like this didn't happen in the midst of the Super 8s when Mayo season is, say, still alive, but they get hammered by Dublin in the first Super 8s game or something like that. And then the summer starts to fall apart. Look, I don't think they're contenders this year. I don't think they're anywhere near where they were in 2017, 2015. But maybe it's a good thing that it's come to a head. And look, I don't know. It's a pity, but... That's that.
Ronan O'Gara's column in the Irish Examiner this morning. The big takeaway, this team needs young blood, he writes in relation to Ireland. He was talking about watching the game at the weekend and doing the punditry that he was doing, obviously, on Virgin Media Sport afterwards, and was saying that we're going to have to change this up, he says, in paraphrasing it. He says, it reminded me of what the police chief said in Jaws when he was when he saw the size of the killer shark terrifying the local beach. We're going to need a bigger boat, is what he thinks applies to Ireland. He said, I've been told that I was momentarily stuck for words on the TV after the game. The silence was clocked at 5.4 seconds. I'm friendly with a few of the players, only a few at this stage, but the pregnant pause last Sunday on the TV was because I didn't know what point to jump off from. I wasn't holding back. I was just shocked by what I saw. So
we're well used to pregnant pauses from Ronan O'Gara.
Yeah. 5.4 seconds.
5.4 seconds, yeah. I watched it in real time. I watched it live. And it really did feel like that amount of time.
We'll have a good Raj pause.
Yeah.
Which we'll do on the papers for the minute. Tommy, thanks for that for now. A couple more stories might come back to a little bit before we leave you at 9:30, but it's just gone 8:25 on this Friday morning. You're watching OTB AM. It's Adrian with you, as always, on a Friday. It's the Sports Breakfast Show from Off the Ball. We've lots still to come. Alan Quinlan is going to join us in studio. Shane McEntee, as Tommy mentioned, will be along to discuss those Jarlath Burns proposal. Tommy Welch, though, is coming up in just a few minutes right here on OTB AM. We're also going to be, as I said, talking to those other guests before we leave you. But here's the GAA presidential candidate, Jarlath Burns, talking about the perceptions of the GPA.
Strategically, it has been a problem in the sense that you have this highly professional operation operating out of the GPA, coming up, butting up against, let's say, old-style chairs of county boards who feel that they're almost being bullied by the demands of the GPA and by the previous deal that was done. And I think that the answer to that probably lies in, you know, the president of the GAA, John Horan, has created this culture of meeting the county chairs. They're the people who are driving the association in the counties, and they're the people with all of the expertise. They understand what's going on. And when I met Paul Flynn, I said, Paul, you definitely have an image problem amongst the GAA. I mean, the GPA are hated, detested in the counties by all the volunteers. And I don't like that image that they have. It's not good for the association. And my advice to the GPA was, you go out and you go to attend the next meeting of county chairs and you talk to them about the work that you do and explain to them the work that you do and try and get a situation where we're all working in partnership, because I don't agree with the politics of the bogeyman. That's populism. So you blame, you know, it's too easy to blame somebody and say, that person's to blame, that organisation's to blame, so if we get rid of them, eradicate them and all, that's populism. Life is far more complex than that, Joe, and we all need to work in partnership. We have devolved one of our values of player welfare to the GPA. We should work with them a wee bit better in order to try and get them to achieve that.
Right, we're going to get Tommy Welch on the line in just a moment to get his reaction to that. I think before that we've clipped Babs Keating was in with Nathan during the week, and they'd a range of different things to talk about. You can again check out the full pieces up on offtheball.com, but here's Babs in conversation with Nathan.
Do you enjoy watching hurling as it is at the moment?
I don't.
Why?
No, I don't. I think the end of the road for me came last Saturday evening with what I saw, Nathan. What I saw in Croke Park last Saturday was the worst of all time, with 13 yellow cards, 3 reds, a penalty that shouldn't have been even a free. And as we know, goals decide games. Mm. And a penalty in the modern game with the present hurling ball that we're playing with is a goal 9 times out of 10. And what I saw in Croke Park, and I described it as more like one of Pat Short's programmes or shows on Kilniscully, to see a Wexford official running in with a new ball every time Wexford got a free. Now, for a GAA that professes to be so professional, with what I saw was beyond belief. And it's the referee going back discussing incidents with the umpires, that incidents happened beside him. Like, I just couldn't take what I saw. If Christy Ring and Eddie Kerr were playing with a hurling ball that's been used today, the opposition would have to bring a carpenter with them and barricade the goal. Like, it makes sense. When you were playing with the ball that our generation played with and all through the 80s, you were playing with a ball that travelled 85 yards at the most. So that makes it that digits on to the 21s and the short frees. Like, I would love to be playing with the ball we're playing with today. You're playing, like, all the players today are using a 35-inch hurley because the hurling ball is so easy to control, so easy to strike.
Like, what did you use?
All 37-inch.
Right.
All 37-inch. Because you wouldn't be able to strike the hurling ball today with the 35-inch hurling. You just couldn't. You know what I mean?
Why?
Well, the ball was so heavy and so it was a bit large, and they were man-made at the time with a ridge around it. Now, I'm not advocating that, but I'm advocating that a hurling ball should be tested and shouldn't travel more than 90 yards in normal conditions.
It doesn't seem like there's any huge appetite for that. Big scores generate excitement.
Okay, but I'm saying to you it's the root of the problems for some of the referees and some of the umpires.
Yeah, Babs keeping in conversation with Nathan there during the week. We are going to look ahead to the weekend's hurling now in just a minute. But before all that, I don't know if you've seen the latest viral sensation, but take a look.
Jeez, can't seem to find the lads anywhere in the snow. They're hard. There's a lot of noise coming out of this caravan. Hey, what's going on in here?
Taggy's inspired us. Give up the hurling and start the dancing.
Yeah! Text in to 53125. Woo!
Tommy, explain yourself.
Yeah, it's rarely a laugh at your own jokes, really, but it's funny enough, in fairness. We were there last Tuesday night, Pancake Tuesday. We were all up in Mammy's and, you know, sure, we were all home, and in fairness, Martin's wife Claire was down from Dublin, down from Talla. She was making the pancakes for the first time. So Shane got in a phone call earlier on today or the day before from Kayling, a girl from Urlingford, to maybe do a little video just to support Taggy. So Shane and his bright idea is anyway, just said we use the caravan, Father Ted, and sure, went down anyway. Like, we'd often send out a text, you know, maybe someone's birthday or someone's getting married or 80th or, you know, and so on and so forth, and you never hear anything else again. Like, it's sent on the WhatsApp. Jeez, the minute we went back up to the house, 20 minutes later, the phones were absolutely hopping. So, listen, it could easily have went wrong too, but it was a bit of crack, and sure, it's just kind of a, you know, supporting Taggy really in the Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, it's brilliant. You're watching much of them?
Oh, yeah, watch it every Sunday night. That's great when you know somebody in it. Now, we would have watched it throughout the years, but it's great then when you have your own friend dancing in it, and he's so good, like, as well. You know, you'd be proud of him. And we always knew he had great rhythm. When we were out nightclubs and off in foreign holidays and that, he was always the guy we sent out into the dance floor for the dance-offs, and he had great rhythm, and you could even see that in the hurling field. And he's great fun to be around as well, so there's no surprise that he's doing well on Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah, so you're saying it's not necessarily a direct transferable skill set, Tommy, not for everybody, like?
Well, you have to have a rhythm. So if you have rhythm, you can do it. But as well, I think, judging by the comments on Dancing with the Stars, they're blown over by his work ethic. But we wouldn't be, because we've seen that from the minute he came in on the Kenny panel. His work ethic was serious. Like, between gym work, core stretching, his work rate on the field, tackle count, and the big day didn't matter, big day, small, he did it every day. So, I'm delighted that everybody else in the whole country, because I suppose the likes of the TJ Reeds and the Henrys and JJs and Noel Arkins, you know, and Taggy was kind of the unsung hero, really, but we knew he was a hero in our dressing room. And it's great to see that the whole country is kind of getting to see his personality and you know, his work ethic.
Yeah. What sort of a pancake filling did you go for?
Well, to be honest, I just ate them. So I don't know what was in them, but they were nice. But, chocolate spread was on one of them anyway. Some sort of syrup as well, but whatever was on them anyway, I was eating them.
Legs into them. Why not? Tommy, let's get into it, the hurling at the weekend. And obviously, Congress upcoming, and a lot of chat about the black card in hurling, obviously, over the last while. It seems like it was a conversation that was entertained for a little while. But, I mean, the latest development was the GPA survey yesterday. I don't know if you've seen this, but something like 89% of respondents came back to say that the black card in hurling wasn't something that they wanted. Some would say, Tommy, that you do away with cards in hurling altogether. But it seems like this one particularly is not going to come in. And I'm sure that's something to welcome.
Yeah, like, you bring in the black card came in the Gaelic football because they were having issues with the cynical fouling, and you know, game to game, there's always going to be some cynical fouling. But if there's no one really complaining too much about it, why try and solve a problem that's not there? So I don't think cynical fouling. Listen, I know people who say there is cynical fouling in hurling, but we don't see it as a problem, as in, like, it doesn't happen too often. And really, when it does happen, there is scores come off it. So I don't think it's an issue in hurling. So why bring in something that will probably cause more issues than anything?
Well, your former colleague, Tommy, sorry to cut across, your former colleague, Eddie Brennan, was talking about it and saying that there might be a need to bring something in, that it isn't the black card, but there might be the requirement to bring something in, whether it's a free on the edge of the D or there's an accumulation of fouls at some point, you then have some sort of a sanction after that.
Why, though? I'd say, Adrian, why? We're all, like, the last 2 years have been the greatest hurling years that many people are saying. Say 2 years ago was the greatest hurling year of all time. Last year was a great hurling year. The games, the scores are absolutely brilliant. The entertainment is brilliant. Why change it? So, like, you know, if there's something broken, yeah, try and fix it. But
yeah,
I see, but you have a great game. Everyone's in love with the game. There's more counties at the top of the game than there ever was. What's the point in changing it? I can't see any point in it.
Yeah, I know even Bubbles was saying during the week that, again, everybody's on the side of whatever, whether you think there needs change or not, this black card isn't the solution, and he was certainly backing that up. But he was saying something like an extra on-field official. But from your point of view, none of that is required.
Yeah, I think an extra on-field official would actually cause more issues in the game, because if we've seen the refereeing last weekend, Adrian, like, why are people complaining? There's too many frees. And I can see from both sides, the referee's point, right, every foul that they are blown is a free. So on the other side, we want a fast, free-flowing game. You can't have it everywhere. So I think we've seen both sides of it. We've seen when referees let the game flow, as we say, so they're not calling every single little small foul. And then we've seen referees that call absolutely everything. Which game does the majority of the people love watching? Which game does the majority of people love playing? Which is the game that the majority of the people love managing? We all know it's the free-flowing, fast-flowing hurling. So I think we just have to maybe... Like, I think a lot of the issues with the refereeing at the moment is this kind of reviewing them by television afterwards, both in the media and both themselves by the referee assessors. So, like, you would take it if you're a hurler. You play through a game, you know, 10 or 15 balls come down into your area. After every single game, your manager, say Brian Cody, if you're from Kilkenny, brings you into a room, goes through every single play. This is what you've done wrong here. This is what you should be looking out for. Right, you did this thing right. I think there's no player would enjoy that. And that's what we're doing to the referees. We're going through every single free. Well, I don't know. I think this is what they do when they're reviewing them. They go through these videos of their games and say what they did right and wrong. I would rather if they use their gut feeling, right? It's okay to leave the assessors there up in the stand, because we all want to improve refereeing, we want to improve hurling. But maybe assess them on your gut feeling. So last weekend, you'd say maybe to Johnny Murphy, Johnny, listen, you know, probably blown a bit too much there. The next day, maybe, you know, you can play a bit of advantage, let it flow a little bit more and just see how it pans out. And I think that would be much more beneficial. Yeah. And I think the referees themselves would enjoy it more.
We do live, obviously, in the world of VAR, and I suppose that's probably one tends to infiltrate the other. Like, I suppose the last point on it, Tommy, maybe it comes back to the point that Babs was making there just previously in relation to the weight of the ball. I suppose the one thing that you might say would be that, obviously, players now have the capacity to belt the Schlitter pretty much the length of the pitch, and it's in every way impossible, obviously, for the referee to keep up with play. If something is going on at that end, they're reliant on a couple of umpires who, and there's been conversations about that as well over the last few weeks, you know, who frequently aren't necessarily that qualified to be making those calls. That's probably the large case for it.
That they're not able to keep up with the play because the ball is moving too fast. I don't agree with that. I think the problem is they're seeing too much, you know, because when you see it all, like, when are people giving out about referees? When they're sending offs for something that's kind of innocuous, and when there's too many frees. So a referee that's going to be able to keep up the play, sure, is going to see more.
And but he might. I suppose. Look at the. It might be a case that where there is a sending off, that referee could end up being 30, 40 yards away from the action. Might not actually see a huge amount. It's sort of relying on a little bit of hearsay. It might not have a clear view of it. And I guess if there was the point where once it passes the halfway line, the other referee is in play, and they've got a view of that, and it may well have not been a sending off, or may not have been a free.
Yeah, but I think the sending off one is easy. Like, you can just consult with your two umpires and your linesmen. So, like, the sending offs really are technically sending offs, you see, Adrian. That's the issue here. Like, if you go to the rule book, technically most of the sendings off are sendings off. But I don't think that's what the people want, because some of them are mistakes. They're just, when you use a hurl, you're using your arms, there's a lot of things can go wrong when you're trying to tackle somebody. Yeah. You're moving so fast towards you. So, you know, it might, your hurl might hit off someone maybe a little bit higher. Like, say, take Conor McDonald's, for example. A guy was trying to go past him. He stuck out the hurl and hit him in the stomach. So I'd say probably in the rule book, that probably is sending off. But any keen supporter and follower of hurling knows he left out the hurl. Listen, he lifted out a little bit late. There was no one hurt or there was no one injured. It wasn't dangerous. And just let it off, like, but probably, the referee probably knew, right, this is going to be on the Sunday game tonight. It's probably going to be trialled by various different camera angles. Was it technically a sending off? Yes, it was, and I better send them off. Towards, if you didn't have any of that, you know, like, so no, going back to your point, I don't think that would improve the game. Or
Well, I think I mean, even when it comes to that, even outside of the Sunday game, when, like you rightly identified, that he'll be sitting down with whatever the referees, assessors are within Croke Park, and they'll be making that same decision, and they'll be deciding that, I suppose, out the other side of that, if it was a sending off and he hasn't taken that action, that by the letter of the law, that he's going to have his games curtailed. I don't know how it works, but we'll see.
I think the question we'll probably have to ask ourselves just before you go is, do we want every foul? The referee could have a brilliant game, and it's a terrible game to watch because he sees every single technical foul. He sees every free. So do we want the game refereed absolutely wonderful and every free called? Or do we want to see entertainment? Do we want to see a great game where a referee is allowed, uses kind of common sense, let a free go here and there might be a bit of advantage? So I think that's the question we might have to ask ourselves as a GA community.
Yeah. Bad news for Kilkenny during the week, Tommy. Obviously, this is a massive blow, obviously, to the player himself, and you assume by knock-on to Kilkenny's season as well, with the news that Adrian Mullen is out.
Yeah, very disappointing. You'd often hear me talking about these extra special players, you know, the Ozzie Gleesons, the Shamey Callanans, the Tony Kellys. Adrian Mullen is one of those type fellas.
Yeah.
Like, in the gym, he's supposedly absolutely brilliant. In his 100-metre sprints, he's absolutely brilliant. We've seen what he can do on the big day for both Ballyhale and for Kenny as a young player. So it's a terrible... I think that possibly could be the third brother to do it in that family. I know Darren definitely done it twice, and possibly Paddy might have done his cruciate, but they're after being hit with terrible cruciate luck in that family. And Adrian's a special player, and we all speak very, very highly of him because we've been watching him both with St Kieran's College, Ballyhale and with Kilkenny.
Yeah, what sort of an impact? This is obviously a guy that hit the scene in a big way last year, the Young Player of the Year. Very, very quickly, Kilkenny become not quite reliant on him, but he'd certainly become a mainstay of that team. In terms of the prospects for the year, Tommy, what sort of an impact does that have?
Yeah, sure. When one of your best players gets injured, it absolutely hurts you. But I think the mindset you have to say is these things happen and you have to get on with it. Like, it happens to great teams all the time. Players getting sent off, maybe missing All-Ireland finals, players with injuries. But over a whole season, it's one less guy that Wexford or Galway or anyone in the Leinster Championship, Dublin, Leash will have to look out for. They can maybe put more focus on Mark and TJ, on Mark and Richie, on Mark and Wally, Billy Ryan from Ballycallan. So yeah, no, it's going to hurt them. But listen, they have to get on with it. It's happened to many teams. Look at the Gooch got injured when Kerry were supposed to be gone back in 2014 or 15, and it looked like Kerry's chances were gone. Who stepped up to the plate? James O'Donoghue had an outstanding season. So it might be a chance for some other young player to step up and drive it on.
Yeah, just at such a young age, it was, and everybody was so, the hurling public were so keen to obviously see him in the year ahead is another aspect of that. Similar enough situation at Limerick as well, Tommy, obviously with Richie English, and that, I mean, one of the great areas of strength obviously for that Limerick team across the full back line. Is this, is an injury like that for a team like that potentially the difference between ultimate success or not, or how do Limerick go about managing that specific one?
No, it'll definitely hurt you, and when any of your best players become injured, it hurts your team. But that's where the panel come into it, and this is where the manager is very important. That he kind of, well, he's you know, commiserating with the player and gives him every encouragement to get back into to the team the following year and drives them on that way. I think it's separate when you have to look at your own team. So Brian Cody would have been brilliant at that over the years. Listen, he would have said, listen, feel sorry for the player, and he's a great servant, but let's get on it. We're a panel. We don't depend on anybody. John Kiley looks like he's the same sort. He's a school principal. He's always bringing, there's no one safe on the Limerick team. We've seen that over the last couple of years. So Richie English has gone, a brilliant cornerback, and has been outstanding. And himself and Mike Casey, and the year they won the All-Ireland, I thought they were fantastic. Yeah. And I think young Costello is going to come in. It's just a chance for another player. You know, Paddy O'Loughlin might go back into the corner, but it's just a chance for another player. Now, I think the way the hurling game has gone, it's not as, you know, a cornerback, it's hard to get good cornerbacks, but a lot of time now they're moving everywhere. So you're not, when you're number four, you might be playing everywhere. So they might just slot someone in, yeah. You know, Paddy O'Loughlin or young Costello.
Yeah, just in terms of the games this weekend, like for the odd situation, obviously the Storm Dennis called off game. So some suggestion even this week that tip Galway outside game might not even need to go ahead. So we'll see how that obviously manifests itself. Tipperary, Tommy, specifically, the Waterford game this weekend is probably one of the more interesting ones. Tipperary beaten by a couple of points by Cork, a couple of points by Limerick as well. And no league title for them, I was reading during the week, which I couldn't believe, in 12 years. Remarkable that it's gone that long. From what you've seen, I know Liam Sheedy, listened to him before the Westmeath game, that he was saying that he wasn't that panicked, that they weren't that far off. It's obviously very early in the year. From what you've seen, where are this Tipperary team at now?
Yeah, and the last time they won it, Adrian, Liam Sheedy was the manager. I think it was 2008. Good he came in first or second year and really went for it, and he beat the Kenny team that was on top at the time, and probably sent out a message to the rest of the country that we're here to stay. We know Liam Sheedy treats the league very seriously. He did last year as well, although they didn't go on and win it or even get to the final. He definitely put out strong teams in every game. So where are they at? I think they're trying to find players. I always found with Liam Sheedy, he settles down the team coming near the end of the league. So you will see the likes of Callanan and the Bubbles, these boys will be coming back if he wants them on the team. Callanan scored 1-1 last weekend. I see Barry Heffernan now, they're trying full back. So they have a big decision. They put Ronan Maher back full back in the All-Ireland final last year, and he was outstanding. But I think we all know Ronan Maher's best position is out the field on the half-back line. He's not necessarily a marker. So he was out centre-back last weekend to give Paddy Maher a rest and to put Barry Heffernan in full back. Barry Heffernan had an outstanding All-Ireland final last year. Absolutely superb, both in the air and on the ground. So I'd say we'll probably see Barry Heffernan get a chance at the full-back position over the next couple of games and see, will he be the man to take him into the championship? You will see that team now starting to settle down. So what are they looking for? Sheedy will probably try and bring in one or two new players. He won't upset the apple cart too much. So I reckon Jake Morris, he's after having a great league. He was brilliant with the under-20s and under-21s the last couple of years. He scored another goal, I think, there at the weekend. So I'd say Jake Morris is definitely one. Keane Darcy is another guy that we'll look at. So Mark Keogh from Kilsheelan was tried during the league. But I'd say young Darcy and Jake Morris will probably be the guys he'll look to freshen up the team.
What are you thinking in terms of the Galway Cork game? The Galway almost in a position at a time where they can't afford to lose this, and it went large portions last weekend without scoring. You can look at that either way, obviously, that some of those scores go over and suddenly they're on the other side of it. But your take on where that Galway team are at this juncture?
Yeah, Galway are playing Cork, and I think probably both are in different places. Galway are definitely trying to find their team. So they had a team, a kind of a core group that has been thereabouts the last couple of years. They have a new manager in now, Shane O'Neill. So there's a lot of their minor winners and under 21 teams, they're starting to get their chances now. I was looking even up through the middle, like Garold McInerney, who has always been there, young Cooney, centre back, Concannon, centre forward. So definitely kind of he's trying out new guys, and we will definitely see a different, I'd say, Galway team come championship. who is showing the most promise? Cathal Mannion is best position seems to be midfield, so he's out there again, and I'd like to see him. He likes the freedom of the park, moving around, using his athleticism, using his speed. He was outstanding out there last year, as opposed to the confines inside. And then you have Conor Whelan. Just looking at Conor Whelan physically, and even his hurling wise, he's been outstanding this year, and he's turned into the new leader. And this is what you want with teams. You want the new lads who are kind of biding their time when they're 19, 20, 21, but then taking on the mantle of leadership, that give me the ball when needs are greatest. And he was brilliant again last weekend, Conor Whelan, and I'd expect him to have a big championship. So where are Galway? I think they're really trying to find players and settle down. I think we're going to have a new Galway team and a lot of new players on the team come the Leinster Championship. Towards, they're playing Cork. I've seen a different Cork the last couple of weeks. So Dermot O'Sullivan is in. He's trojan up and down the sideline. He's in. He's berating referees. He's driving them on. They know to win in All-Ireland, they're going to have to increase their work rate and their forward line aging. They're going to have to get in hooks. They're going to have to get in blocks. And the key, there's three key men to that Cork team. And if they're going to win the All-Ireland, I would expect these three lads to have a big summer. That's Decky Dalton from Father O'Neill's. He had an outstanding club campaign. He was brilliant both with him, McKilly, and with Father O'Neill's. Aidan Welch, we saw he scored a powerful goal last weekend. They're usually balls into the corners. The Cork Forest darting here, darting there, lovely balls over from the corner. No, straight ball into the edge of the square. Aidan Welch comes in, shoves a few lads out of the way, catches it, puts it in the back of the net. And Harnedy, we all know Harnedy's probably been trying to carry that mantle on his own for the last couple of years. So they've three physical lads now, and if they're going to win in All-Ireland, it's when we're out in the crowd in Páirc Uí Chaoimh or Turles or somewhere, and we see something like Decky Dalton running 40 yards and hooking a lad or shoving a lad out over the line. The Cork crowd will get behind him. Dermot O'Sullivan, The Rock will get behind him. Kingston will get behind him. And we'll see a Cork team that finally probably sees what it's going to take to win in All-Ireland. So I think they're pushing hard for that. I'm seeing a lot of hooks, a lot of blocks the last couple of weeks. And yeah, it'll be interesting. But I think they're both in different places, Cork and Galway.
Yeah, all right. Interesting times. Tommy, thanks a million.
Yeah, thanks, lads.
Cheers, thanks a lot. Tommy Welch on the line there, ahead of the weekend's hurling and his thoughts too on the black card and everything else besides. If you just came in towards the end of that, you can check out the full piece a little bit later up on offtheball.com. Alan Quinlan is going to be with us in a few minutes' time. It's 7 minutes to nine on this Friday morning. We've got the sports news next with Tom, but here's our piece with David Brady. If you saw little bits of this, it was earlier in the week on the pain of dealing with defeat.
But, were you quick to park them, all those four defeats? You were?
Yeah.
Like a month, a week, how long?
It's not that you're embarrassed. I mean, I'm, and I've been cognizant. I'm never at the level that Johnny Sexton is at.
Sure.
And he's there in front of us as a picture of him now. What do you think Johnny Sexton felt like Monday?
Horrific.
Absolutely horrific.
Yeah.
And an absolute, I won't use it, a disgrace, the words that were said about him.
Agreed, yeah.
But imagine how he feels, and that's it. And you're going, you don't want to make eye contact. You don't want to see anyone. Mm. You just want to go away. You just want to hide and say sorry.
Yeah, because I guess people have travelled from overseas, you're
it's
carrying
just,
all that.
It's just, you feel you let everyone down. Mm. But look at, this is a different complex altogether. Johnny Sexton knows. Mm. Give me time. Mm. Give me an opportunity. And give me a chance of getting back on the bike. And that's the way I took it. Get me out. Get me in the club team. Get me back where I have strength around and unity in a club.
Yeah.
And that's the one glorious feeling. It's the hardest time to put on your boots.
Yeah.
Great, watch that. Watch it back. David Brady in conversation with Joe from a little bit earlier in the week. Tom Long, good morning to you.
Hey, Adrian, you all right?
How's it going?
Yeah, not too bad.
You were not watching the Europa League last night.
No, I was at the Ross O'Carroll Kelly reading with Paul Howard and Ada Gole at the Mill Theatre in Dundrum, and it was absolutely brilliant.
Right.
Yeah. It was some stuff, man, I gotta say. So it's the stories, like obviously some readings from the book and whatever, and then a few stories as well, and it was well worth it. So
worth going to.
You can catch that. The two in Dundrum were sold out, but I think he was touring it a bit. But yeah,
that's recommendation.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, we'll start with Europa League. Manchester United, Wolves and Rangers will be in the draw for today's last 16 of the Europa League. But both Arsenal and Celtic will be watching on, worrying about what might have been. Arsenal lost 2-1 on the night to Olympiacos and went out in away goals, having conceded a minute from the end of extra time at the Emirates Stadium. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang missed a late opportunity to send the Gunners through. And Arsenal boss Mikel Arteta says it hurts to go out of the Europa League.
We are still far from the objective that we all have, but we've been far all season from it. And we have to keep fighting again, game by game. There's no point about making big plans. The most important thing is that dressing room has to lift up now.
Some comical defending, meanwhile, saw Celtic lose 3-1 to Copenhagen last night and go out 4-2 on aggregate. Manager Neil Lennon admits the team only have themselves to blame.
As you can imagine, I'm hugely disappointed. We basically shot ourselves in the foot because we had a great opportunity and we've let it go. You know, so it's bitterly disappointing to have lost. And just in the manner in which we lost, because we were the better team for huge parts of the game.
Matt Doherty scored for Wolves, who they actually lost 3-2 away to Espanyol, but still went through 6-3 on aggregate. While Manchester United hammered at 10-man Bruges by 5-0 at Old Trafford, going through 6-1 on aggregate. Odion Ighalo scored his first goal for the club as they sealed a 6-1 aggregate success. And boss Ole Gunnar Solskjaer admits he's pleased for the January signing.
As a striker, fellow striker myself, I know how important that first goal is, and he's been close a couple of times. You can see he sniffs goals. He wants to be there where it sometimes hurts, but he's that goal as well, he's sharp in his head. That's a natural striker.
And the two best sides in the country will renew their rivalry this evening. One of them is going to lose a 100% record, though, as champions Dundalk make their first trip of the year to Tallaght Stadium to take on cup holders Shamrock Rovers. Elsewhere tonight, Bows are looking to make it 3 in a row when they travel to Derry City. There's a Dublin derby at Tolka Park as Shelburne entertains St Patrick's Athletic. And Cork City will be looking for their first points of the campaign. They welcome Finn Harps to Turner's Cross. In the First Division, Cabinteely go to Athlone. Bray hosts Wexford. Drogheda take on Longford, and UCD play Cove Ramblers. All those games get underway at 7:45. While in the Premier League, Leicester City are looking for a first Premier League win in a month when Brendan Rodgers' Foxes head to the bottom side, Norwich City. That kicks off at 8. Elsewhere in the UK, a winding up petition against Oldham Athletic has appeared from Her Majesty's Revenues and Customs. A date for that set for the 18th of March, although the club, formerly managed by Paul Scholes, of course, formerly Terence Irwin played there as well before he went to United, but they say they will clear that outstanding debt before St Patrick's Day. While in golf, Shane Lowry recorded a 1-under-par round of 69 on day one of the Honda Classic on the PGA Tour. It could have been better from the Offaly man, who was 3-under-par through four with a share of the lead early on, but undid some of that good work on the back nine. The lead currently shared by Tom Lewis and Harris English on 4-under-par. Pádraig Harrington 2-over-par in that one. The new president of the elect of the GAA will be elected at the annual Congress tonight, with a motion to bring in a black card in hurling set to be defeated as well. Armagh's Jonathan Burns, of course, we've seen in the show, is seen to be the front runner to be the new president. In rugby, Leinster will look to maintain their 100% record across all competitions. They entertain Glasgow in the Pro 14 at the RDS this evening. That gets underway at 7:35. And finally, there's racing later from Dundalk.
Good stuff. Thanks for your time. Thanks for that. Just about to go 9 o'clock on this Friday morning. We've Alan Quinlan standing by to chat all things rugby. Brian O'Driscoll was on Thursday's OTB AM. Here he is on what went wrong for Ireland against England and how the game their game plan was so effective.
Sometimes when you play professional rugby, you do a play and it works. And the immediate feeling is, gosh, you know, we've done that once. They'll have seen it. We've got to try and find some kink to change that up a little bit. But more often than not, you know, systems aren't in place to be able to cope with something, particularly in real time in the same game. So go back to using it a second time. And because the Irish defence hasn't changed dramatically, they put so much focus on the fullback covering that backfield that England identified getting, if they could get into the wide channels and put those little grubber kicks through, that, you know, with the bouncing of a rugby ball, you know, equal opportunities on what way it's going to go. And it fell for them this time round, as it did 13 months ago as well in the Aviva. In fact, in the first minute, was it? Yeah, after the high ball. So we talked about Jonathan Joseph in advance being, you know, out of position and whether we'd test them well. You know, they certainly went after the proficiency of Jordan Larmour in the air. There were two high balls within the first 2 minutes, two takes for England. First one was Elliot Daly, and Larmour gets stuck in the ruck. And actually, George Cruz tried a little grubber through, which bounced off Conor Murray. Absolutely the right option. It's a foot race with Larmour getting back on his feet and Johnny May in the corner. Johnny May's a quicker player than him. If it had been a better quality kick, that could have been a score within 70 seconds. So I just thought they picked their options brilliantly on top of their crazy physicality, you know, with and against and with the ball and in defence. We just had no answers for them, and I think they rattled us. And I was reading Gordon Darcy this morning, and he's gotten it spot on. The fanning out of their defence, the only way to counter that is to pick and jam around the ruck and make it more honest and get numbers to pile in. Their spacings were it was so easy for them. They had this crazy width that we could never get to the extremities because they had, you know, 2 meter gaps between everyone. They let the ruck go, and that's where you've got to make them honest and pick and jam and look after, you know, get after that guard, the first person beside the ruck, and make him honest, and then suck everyone in as a result, and then you can go to the extremity.
Right, 9 o'clock, Friday is OTB AM. You can check out Brian's full chat with Jaron Owen up on offtheball.com. Alan Quinlan, good morning to you.
Morning, Adrian.
What's happening?
All is quiet now.
Good? How was your pancakes?
Quiet weekend. It was good, Jeff.
Very nice. I was talking to Tommy Welch earlier on. He was saying he wasn't actually that sure what was in them. Did you have any pancakes?
I did. I bought them on Super Value.
Listen, that's the way to do it. What sort of a filling would you be? Jesus, a fruit man or a...
No, just plain.
Plain.
A maple syrup on them. Happy days.
Tipperary style.
Exactly, yeah.
You've watched this game back a few times, have you?
I have, yeah.
What
are my thoughts now? I think, obviously, I was thinking, and a lot's been said about the physicality and the power that England exerted, but I think looking back at the game, I think... And a lot of it came from the pressure from England. Some of the decision-making was poor. The lines are running.
The pressure was unreal. It was right there from the start, and it was relentless all the way through.
Yeah, it was relentless. And I think, obviously, Ireland tried to bring their wingers up a little bit, and there was a bit of space in the backfield and a few mistakes as well. So mistakes happen.
Of space in our backfield.
Yeah, there was space in the backfield, and I think for the first try, Jordan Larmour was over a little bit left, and there was a fair bit of space that England had probably identified before the game that possibly could be, and they exploited that. And, you know, people said to me I was a bit negative with my views on the game, and I think you just have to be realistic. If you watch back the game, you know, a lot of people obviously watch the game on Sunday, and do they go back and watch it again? And you see other things. You know, it's sometimes that reactive analysis when you look at a game. But I think when you look back, and I think it sometimes gives more hope than actually you think we're not good enough and things were so bad. And, you know, sometimes you look at that. But when you look back at games, and that's why professional athletes and amateur athletes and teams analyse the performance. You try and show where you went wrong, and a lot of it is fixable at times. I think the concern, obviously the biggest concern, is the psychological scars of maybe what happened in 2019, and after making some progress in the first two games, maybe that it's a step backwards. Yeah. Mentally, it's not, you know, many teams can go to Twickenham and lose. Most teams are going to be under the pump. They're under massive pressure. There,
it feels like the gulf. I mean, maybe that's what you're hinting at. The gulf now between Ireland and England. Like, you frequently hear, listen, if Ireland play up to their best on a day, they can beat England.
Well, the template is there. Like, so aside from quality and having really good players, which they normally have, I know there's often times over the years where they're you see vulnerabilities in their selections and stuff like that, and you question some selections, and there was a lot of question marks about Eddie Jones's back row, Jonathan Joseph on the wing, whether Farrell should start at 10, yeah. Ford off the team, all that kind of stuff. There was loads of debates, and lots of the English media were speaking about their back row. Based on the evidence we saw against France, they were poor and it was imbalanced and stuff. But so any team can go to Twickenham and get a walloping, because they're very imposing at home. And Ireland need to start the game well, and they didn't. But probably the concern is there's an underlying issue here of three times against England, three times being physically outmatched, three times being not able to cope with the pressure, three times not being able to play your own game and impose yourself. And you know, some of the errors and the mistakes, the knock-on from Rob Herring, the pass from Johnny Sexton to Bundiacki where he knocked it on as well. There was a couple of things like that. England swallowing us up when we tried to maul the ball a couple of times. And they just looked to have more intent and more aggression and energy. And as I said, I've been out in the field there. The players, it's hard when that's happening to change it and turn it around. It's really, really difficult. What you need sometimes is a big moment, a big turnover. And I think Bundiacki got a big turnover in the first half, and I thought maybe that'll relieve a little bit of pressure. But you've got to be intelligent in your decision-making. 7 minutes in, and Jordan Larmour is an incredibly talented player, and his feeling of the ball has improved. His positional sense has improved. Could it be better? Yes. Rob Kearney was just a master at fielding high ball.
Would we have been better served with Rob Kearney at fullback?
You know what? In the game that, in a game like that, where England kicked the ball 25 or 6 times, they kicked it 8, maybe 10 times more than Ireland. So Ireland have continuously been kind of spoken about a team that kicked the letter off the ball. And England, like, I did England-France last year in Twickenham. They scored 7 or 8 tries. They kicked the ball 44 times in the game. Yeah. 44 times. Nobody left the stadium that day thinking England kicked it too much. If you kick well and you get a return off your kicks, it's seen as exciting.
Well, that last part, I presume that Kearney not being a fullback and Larmour being there and being somewhat intestine.
It was a couple of, small mistakes that
but
he learned from.
But I presume that informs the England game plan. They see Larmour at fullback.
They're always, when you see an inexperience, if George Furbank played for England, a fullback who started the first couple of games, if he was there, Ireland would have tried to expose him. But I just think it was a little bit of position. He caught the ball on 7 minutes where there was a crossfield kick from forward, and he caught it really well, had a chance to mark it, didn't mark it, decided to run back, got tackled by Elliot Daly, an impact tackle, so behind the Irish gain line. That ruck was a bit of a dogfight to try and win it. Then Ireland played infield to Devon Toner, who got knocked backwards as well. And then Conor Murray tries to kick in a harder position where he's hooking the ball back over his own body. The ball doesn't go into touch. Jacob Stockdale gets up as Elliot Daly is catching it and ends up tackling him infield, which was strange.
It was.
And they scored about three phases later, they scored a try. So sometimes when I'm in commentary and with the way I view the game, some people agree, disagree, whatever, but I always think, from being the player out there, and I was the same as a player, those moments can win or lose the game for you. Obviously you've got to extend out, there's an extension to those moments. So if I win a line out against the opposition that they're attacking 5 yards from my line, and I get up and I win that ball, we clear our lines, and playing with Munster back in the day, Rog kicks it down to the halfway line. What are those players thinking who are just on our 5 metre line? They're thinking, we have a great position to score. Suddenly, me or O'Connell or someone goes up, robs the line out, we clear our lines. They're running backwards then, deflated. So it's those psychological moments in all sport. It's the same in GAA and soccer and everything. And we had so many of those big moments in 2018 that, for one reason, for many different reasons, we're not having those moments. We're actually losing those moments now. So that was a classic case of, okay, we haven't won, Jordan Larmour hasn't marked it. Fair enough. He's been tackled here on the 22. Don't play that extra phase. There's no need. Play the box kick or give it straight back to your 10, who drops 10 yards behind the ruck, so it's more difficult for them to run
absolutely
back in it. And he just lamps it the length of the field.
We weren't doing a huge amount of that regardless. And the English defensive line speed, right? I mean, I don't know what sort of a factor.
Just let me finish in that moment. So he drops back 10, kicks it down the field. Yeah. And they're playing in the backfield. They may run back. He mightn't get fine touch, or else put it out in the stand.
Yeah.
Take the sting out of the game. So we play the phase, then we miss touch, then they score the try. Mm. So what you're saying to the opposition is that even if we kick the ball, we're going to get it back pretty quickly and we're going to be back on the attack again. Mm. And it's hard then psychologically to keep defending that. And there was just lots of moments in the first half where Ireland did something good and then just backed it up with poor mistakes, poor decisions, knock-ons, overrunning the ball, a poor execution, a pass from Peter O'Mahony to Stockdale where he overran that, and it wasn't a great pass either. So it has a snowballing effect.
So
I think the issue that they need to sort out now is between their ears, first of all. Mm. Obviously, that might involve some change in the personnel, but the players need to take ownership here themselves, sit down and look back at some of the games and say, look, even though we've had some brilliant highs, like at the World Cup where Scotland was a brilliant performance, Wales was a really good performance a few weeks ago, they've just kind of stepped back, and it's about psychologically changing that.
Can I just ask you one more on the what went wrong before we get into the where do we go from here, to borrow a phrase. That defensive line speed thing, and the so England are right up on top of us.
Yeah.
But the out half is also standing close enough to that line, so he's getting swallowed up in that movement, right? Like, they're out of the blocks every time, like 100 metre sprinters, and shutting down the Irish play, and obviously, like you've said, driving the back. And Sexton is standing close enough to that line, so he's getting swallowed up by it. Why at some point are we not... You talked about the open spaces in the Irish backfield, but like that rush defence must have left space behind behind the English line. We showed at no point any capacity to respond to what was happening in front of us.
And see, there's a nervousness now probably to kick with this Irish group because of maybe the tag of being negative and not playing expansive rugby. So they're trying to play out at their own half. And the way the game has changed now, Adrian, nowadays, because when I played, there wasn't as many people as good at the breakdown, i.e. wingers, fullbacks, centres. I know you'd sporadically get players who were very good, backs and stuff. Sometimes, like right across the board in international rugby now, there's very little weakness in defence. So there's no one you can say, well, we'll run at him and we're going to get over him. He's going to miss tackles. He's a bad tackler. It's very unlikely you're going to encounter that. So you're meeting a strong defence everywhere. You're also meeting incredible poaching ability at the breakdown right across the board, not just your six and seven traditionally who were the ones right across the board. If you're any bit vulnerable to breakdown, you'll have an outside centre, a winger, a fullback, a scrum half robbing the ball. So it's harder and harder to play out a defence now nowadays in the modern game. And if you play out a defence a lot, you're running the risk of a turnover, being pinged for a penalty or making a mistake with the pressure that the opposition are giving you. So I think Dricka was talking about Gordon Darcy mentioning his piece, but it's the same. I was thinking the same. We need to either pick and jam a little bit to just bring in their defence a little bit and kick better. England didn't mess around with the ball in their own half of the field. They actually do kick a huge amount. So it's just been a little bit more intelligent and understanding that, and maybe not buying into the perception that we are this negative team and we've got to run everything. I admire the ambition and the fairness. I think against Wales, Johnny Sexton didn't kick the ball out of hand till the 60th minute or something.
Maybe we need to.
We have to have that mentality. You look at Wales and France on Sunday. Wales actually, through Sean Edwards, I guarantee you, informed them and gave them a template to say, when Wales kick downfield, we'll just kick back and we'll play this kick tennis. Do not run back. Wales want us to run back and smash us and turn the ball over. And
which would be a fairly typical French thing.
So France kept kicking it up, and that actually kind of drove Wales mad a little bit. Yeah. And eventually, someone kicked it out into touch, and the game was there was no real kind of the sting was taken out for those few seconds. So there's a number of things there. There's still a lot of good players there, Adrian. There's still a lot of good characters there.
But you're in agreement with Ronan, are you? That it's new blood time.
Some new blood, like Caelan Doris.
So who are you taking in?
Kelleher,
who are you taking out?
Ian Henderson will probably come back. I'd love to see Alton Land given a chance to start in a game again. I think he brings a real intensity and energy as well. The back three, I said it about Will Addison. I'd try and find somewhere for Will Addison in the side. Keith Earls back into the side.
So you're taking Jacob Sockdale out. If Addison has gone in, you're probably taking Larmour out.
I'm not sure exactly. I think Jacob Stockdale didn't play well last week. He hasn't played as well as he can do. He's a very good player, but hasn't played as well as he can do in recent times in Ireland, in an Ireland shirt. I just think Larmour, Addison, Conway, Earls, they're the natural X-factor footballer players who make stuff happen. So I don't know how you fit four into three there. I've thought this, and I've for any players who get dropped, it's not the end of the world. So if Conor Murray doesn't get selected or dropped the next day, well, that's not the end of Conor Murray. It mightn't be the worst thing in the world to happen to someone like him, because you know what, it takes that pressure off that I've now been dropped. I've now got to rebuild myself and challenge to come back and try and win the jersey again. So it's something that they need to look at. The midfield, we've four really good options there with Aki, Henshaw, Farrell, Ringrose. That balance just doesn't seem right. I don't know. It's there's not enough of creativity there. Obviously, when Ringrose plays, he has that natural flair there. But
he's the one standout,
yeah,
isn't he?
Yeah, and look, the aggression thing is an issue. I think Ireland were, they won those collisions against Wales, and when they do that, and we can do that against the less stronger, more powerful nations, it's game on then. But when you play England, South Africa, and New Zealand, it's, if we're not physically matching them, we're going to be under pressure.
So, just before we wrap, pick your fresh new back row.
Pick my fresh new back row.
So, forgetting about sort of experience.
Well, look, if I was going to Paris tomorrow, I'd pick Stander, Doris, and O'Mahony, based on maybe a bit more physicality, and maybe based on Doris needs to be in the back row. So it's either CJ Stander doesn't play, Peter O'Mahony doesn't play, or Josh van der Fleer doesn't play.
You feel van der Fleer is the weak link?
No,
in that
I don't feel he's the weak link. I just think he didn't play well against England, and I think if you go to Paris, you're playing a big physical side again. And I think, to be fair to O'Mahony, he's responded. I thought he should have been dropped at the start. I think he's responded incredibly well, and that's why I was dropped many times. And you've got to rebuild yourself, and you've a choice to make. It's not the end of the world, I think. Max
Stander's undroppable almost now, isn't he?
I wouldn't say he's undroppable. I think you've got to have a situation now where they're all vulnerable again. But I think Stander has been the one. James Ryan himself and O'Mahony out of the forward pack last week were the three that kind of, you could say, stood up, and they were throwing themselves about. But you can't have three of your forwards having a strong, aggressive reaction and five of them not really been up to that same level. You think you need your eight forwards going to Twickenham really been bullish and working as really tight as a unit. So look, it's not wholesale changes, but probably three or four changes in the team to see if they can change that whole flow.
Shake it up a bit, yeah. I don't know what we're going to talk about next week. We'll see when Monday comes. Thanks a million. Enjoy the weekend. Alan Quinlan, as always, on a Friday morning. 17 minutes past 9 on this Friday. We're going to talk GA with Shane McEntee next. OTB AM. 18 minutes past 9. Tommy's rejoined me in studio. We're going to talk some Gaelic football now. Jarlath Burns, I don't know if you've paid much heed to this week. He was on with Joe during the week and obviously was outlining his pitch to be the new president of the GAA, which will be decided at Congress, the first day of Congress this evening. He was up against four others, but he was in with Joe, running to be the next, the president-elect, as Tom was correctly wording it a bit earlier on. He has some somewhat radical proposals, I would suggest, in relation to the preparation of inter-county teams. He talks about up to the end of the league, inter-county teams can only train on Wednesdays and Fridays. He says that Niall Moyna has been telling him that inter-county players are doing 40% too much training. He would also introduce the idea that county teams can't train until January the 1st. And then he says that teams who break ranks are going to have 10% of their 250 grand GAA funding removed. So whether you view those as radical or not, there are the proposals of Charles Burns as he runs for the GAA presidency this evening. One interesting response caught our eye this week. It was from the Meath footballer Shane McEntee. He says, "I'm really not convinced about this common narrative around reduced training time. Many intercounty players love the organised, detailed setups that allow them to develop at elite levels. Restricting this may lead to players looking elsewhere for elite level training and lifestyle." Shane, good morning to you.
Morning, how are you getting on?
You're dead against it.
Yeah, I suppose I saw that and it caught my eye, and not just from what Jarlath Burns is saying, but I think, you know, over the last while there has been a bit of a common narrative where you get really negative connotations towards the way inter-county teams train these days, with the level of detail, the level of preparation, and, you know, I hear a lot of non-players talking about it in a way that we're nearly sort of prisoners to these advancements in training techniques and equipment and the likes of your GPS trackers, nutritionists, all this, as if it's some sort of evil upon the game that is restricting players and the amount of time we put in. And I just felt, you know, I'm not trying to speak for every player here, because there's clearly going to be different opinions, but I know personally, and I know a lot of other lads really enjoy this. They really love this side of the game, and I don't see the need, or I don't see the appeal. I don't see why such drastic action should even be ran or considered.
Yeah, I'd say the rationale for ultimately from Jarlath Burns' point of view is that obviously we are seeing increasingly the players are having to retire early. There's obviously a lot of major injuries that are happening to players now, given the lengths that they're going to, obviously, in terms of fitness that we may not have been in a position for before. So the foundation, obviously is coming from, interestingly enough, because it's probably the same foundation as your own, in retaining players to the game.
Yeah, and look, I can understand that, and I'll have to admit, I'm coming from a position where, you know, I'm not married with kids, and I've quite a supportive structure around me in terms of family, girlfriend, employers, that make it quite conducive to playing intercounty football. And I understand there's a lot of people who don't have the same circumstances in place. So as I say, I'm only speaking for me and from other people. But I mean, in terms of training time and the injury load, you look at a lot of other serious competitors, people, boxers, runners, cyclists that aren't necessarily competing at a professional level, at an international level. But you take like a good competitive club runner, they're probably training 11. I was chatting to a friend of mine about this yesterday. He's training 11 or 12 hours on his feet a week before physio, before gym work, before conditioning, rehab, whatever else. You take a cyclist who's a good club, not an international level cyclist, he's getting 15, 16 hours on the bike in a week. So in terms of training load, you know, I think while we do train hard and we do make commitments, I don't think we're on our own in that case. I think, you know, there are other sides to this as well.
Shane, good morning, Tommy here. There's a number of pressure points, obviously, in the GAA at the minute, and we're not going to fix them in this room or on a Skype call. But I'm just wondering, what was it that caught your eye about Jarrett Byrne's proposals? For me, he speaks some sense. There's probably some bits of it. Perhaps the 2 days a week is just unsustainable. But one of the major factors, I suppose, has been reducing inter-county spending and also the calendar problem. And I'm just wondering what you think about restricting training to January. If we could get the season to work around it, I know pre-season is important, but if training could be restricted to an 8-month period, or the inter-county season could be restricted to a certain period, would that appeal to you?
Yeah, like, as well, I want to say I did agree with some of his points. You know, you make good points about the college competitions and the struggles they're having at the moment, and I think they're brilliant competitions. But I just think these mass nearly overreactions, I would thought, like, you cancel training in November and December. Who's that benefiting? Is that benefiting the clubs? Do clubs want to play in November and December and you get your inter-county players back then? You know, if I'm not training in November and December, what am I doing? Like, and I don't see why this has to be enforced. I can't think about any other sport where this gets enforced that, no, you're actually not allowed to train there. You know, lads are voluntarily going through it. And I do understand that we have fixtures issues and we're trying to revamp the calendar. But, you know, I really don't envy whoever has to try and sort that out at the same time, because we look at so many of these competitions across a number of different codes, across a number of different age groups, and I find it very difficult to see a working solution, which is difficult. But given the current structures we have, I just don't see why you take away November, December from lads who, as I said, enjoy this high-level elite training. You know, looking at extreme examples, we've talked a lot about how we try and keep our best players from going to Aussie Rules. Obviously the clear lure there is professionalism and money earning and whatever else. Yeah. But if you're trying to appeal to lads on the other level, say, no, we can give you this, we can give you that, and he's a highly driven, highly motivated athlete. We look at Conor Nash and Cian McBride in Meath, and you try telling them to stay at home and they're not going to be training for a couple of months a year.
Can that be a part of it, Shane, that you talked about the sort of professionalism? It's almost heresy to suggest it in some quarters, but that sort of pay-for-play thing would obviously take a lot of this out, because, you know, you have mentioned it already, obviously there are players in different situations to you with families or, you know, massive work commitments where it gets increasingly difficult, I suppose, to have that commitment. Some shape of a pay-for-play would at least take some of that out of it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's never something that's really motivated me. I've never really given it a whole bit of time, to be perfectly honest. As I said, my situation could change, and my current scenario means I don't really feel I'd need it. But, you know, I think that's kind of the sport we signed up for. I think that's what we really, you know, we're doing this because we're passionate about it. So I don't necessarily see a pay-for-play thing coming into it. But that's, again, that's just my personal opinion. I don't want to speak for every Gaelic player on that.
Shane, the phrase that Paul Flynn will use a lot is sustainable amateurism. And I suppose the GAA is constantly struggling to find the balance between, you know, the professional demands that everyone else is striving for and the standards that you guys are trying to set and are striving towards, sorry, and then the amateurism of the game as well and the core values of the game. Just going back to what you were saying about your own personal situation, but also, I suppose, the phase of development that Meath football is in at the minute. You guys are playing Division 1 football for the first time in 10 years. I could tell from speaking to Donald Keoghan on the show earlier in the week, he's a man who is working in medicine and in pharmaceutical biology. I'm not sure if I phrased it right there. But obviously, a lot of time commitments outside of football. Mm. He said he's never once questioned his commitment to Gaelic football or inter-county football. But I just want to flip that. So Meath are in this really exciting phase where you've got a really young team. You've got consistency with Andy McEntee as manager. You're moving towards Division 1. You can see progress. That's Meath. They're perhaps always in around the top 10 over the last couple of years. We're seeing a lot of players this year. And I'm not sure whether it's more than other years. It feels like it is stepping away from the game. Lads in their mid-20s. You would have played football in UCD, and I'm sure you would have played a lot of these guys as well. But I keep going back to the names of Killian Clark and Darren McVitie and Michael Quinlivan and players in Roscommon. Middle-tier counties, you might say, who are stepping away from the game because of the demands. Perhaps these are players who have had a lot of intense underage years as well. Calvin winning a lot of things on those underage teams, minor and under 21. So they've probably had a decade in the game already. For players like that, and I know from speaking, I know this is a long question, but from speaking to players who are perhaps with smaller counties, and they have new managers coming in every year, they're going on trial in November. They're essentially going as hard as they can go from November. And again, with the structures, they might get no benefit out of it when it comes to the following June or July. They're not going to get to the Super 8s the way Meath are. For the counties like that, and I know it's difficult to step away from your own environment, but for the counties outside of the top 10, would you not see the benefit for reducing perhaps training time or trying to put a cap on it? Because as I said at the very start, we're trying to achieve sustainable amateurism here.
Yeah, look, I understand that that's going to be an issue for people, but I'd also say that that's kind of the nature of sport as well. You look at most sports around the world, there's going to be certain teams and certain people that dominate, and you're going to have highly competitive, highly driven people that, unfortunately, through whatever circumstances, maybe can't get to that level. But yeah, no, I'd admit that is difficult. But I do think the GAA is coming around a bit more, that lads are, there's not that same stigma with lads stepping away. Like we've had fellas in the last couple of years, Mickey Newman is one that comes to mind. He's took a year out, got himself sorted, relaxed for a little bit, came back in and was flying. So I think the GAA is becoming a bit more fluid like that it's not as rigid. I still don't know if reducing the training time is going to do that. I really just don't know. Maybe it would in some cases, but again, it's difficult to speak for people from the counties you mentioned, and as well for individual motivators. Like, you know, I just look at it myself. I like the routine. I like being able to test myself. I like being able to, you know, We sat down, a group of us last year, and spoke about the amount of services that we, and I'd imagine most inter-county teams get. You get your nutritionist, your S&C, your psychologist, your medical team, all these sort of things. That if I was, you know, an aspiring club player or aspiring club athlete from another sport, that would cost me a fair bit of money to avail of those services, you know. And by having these well-run and long-run years, we get access to this. So even on a personal level, just in terms of motivating yourself through your own athletic development, that's one of the real pros and real pluses that comes with having these sort of setups. So I just don't, to answer your question, I don't know. It's hard. It's hard to know what it would be like if we went that route. Personally, I'd be afraid of the alternative, because you could have some fellow who's on the cusp of maybe a League of Ireland team or an AIL rugby team where they might get those setups. And if you're taking a good chunk of that year away from them, they might start saying, this is certainly not me, because I wouldn't be next or near any of those teams. But you do have lads in those scenarios that are making decisions, and then you start losing them, and then we're losing some more of our best possible athletes. So I don't know. That's my main thought on it. But I can see there's another side. Yeah, I completely accept that, and it's hard. It's very hard to get a fine balance on this.
Yeah, it's interesting that you are both kind of coming from the same point of view in terms of trying to, that sustainable thing and trying to keep players within the game. Just finally, Anna Cheney, you of the view that it's not these proposals, but something else is acceptable, or are you just saying it should be unregulated, unfettered access to whatever preparation needs to be done?
No, I wouldn't say unregulated because, I mean, we still have a club game that's very important here. You know, and I think there does need to be some sort of structures. But it was more just what got my tail up yesterday a bit was I see so many analysts and pundits, you know, constantly harping this negative drum about the amount of training, the amount of commitment, the amount of restrictions we have. And I just thought this was kind of feeding into that. And I know there was other players with that opinion of me. And I bit the bullet a bit and voiced it. So, yeah, I do feel things are important to keep a balance for lads and to make sure they don't get, at the end of the day, we're not getting paid and I'm not looking to get paid. So, you know, we have to keep some sort of balance at a professional career as possible. Mm. But I just think these extreme measures are completely over the top.
Shane, moving away from that, you're one of a number of Meath players who've been injured this year going into Division 1. What's that been like, missing Division 1 so far this year? I know you're on the way back. How's it been the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, it's tough. It's probably the first sort of long-term injury I've had to deal with. And, you know, you're looking at these games and there's massive effort going in from the lads and it's really, really fine margins that you're falling short of. And I suppose, naturally, your mind starts to think, geez, if we had a couple more of our maybe more experienced players available, what sort of a difference it would make. But I have to say, I've got massive heart out of going and watching the lads play. Like, even you're down in Killarney at the weekend and after 10 or 15 minutes, you're thinking, this could be a really tough day at the office, and we really weren't that far away from taking something out of the game. So while you don't want to be celebrating a loss, and we're not slapping each other on the back saying it's all good, there was definitely great stuff to be taken from it.
Shane, thanks a million.
No problem at all.
Cheers,
thank you.
Shane.
Me,
thanks,
Shane McAtee on the line there. Discussing Gerald Burns' proposals, and Tommy, you have to get a word in there as well about...
Well, playing Galway and Navan on Sunday, and listen, all
United
the talk
are
all week
back and me they're going in the opposite direction.
All the talk all week has been about Galway being all Ireland contenders. Well, wait till they come out of Navan on Sunday.
9:32 on this Friday morning. Tommy, thanks a million for everything this morning. Both sides of the box. Fair play to you. Saturday, by the way, and off the ball tomorrow. The Saturday panel: Michael Lister, Tommy's favourite guest, probably of all time.
Michael Lister,
probably up there, I'd say.
Yeah, we should get him back in soon enough.
Michael Lister, David Kelly and Sarah Donovan are going to review the week. Stephen Elliott and Dan are going to be in alongside Shane Keegan and John. We believe there's going to be an interview with the new GA president, whoever that might be, at some point Saturday afternoon as well. It's quite the promise to make, given that we don't know who...
Well, Maura Trostany Kelly is going to be at Congress and she will deliver an interview one way or the other.
Sunday from 1 o'clock as well. You can subscribe on all the usual channels. We're going to see you Monday morning from 7:30. From us for this morning, good morning.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.